Have you seen the price of gold lately? It's hitting all-time highs. And when it comes to investing in gold, check out Noble Gold Investments. They have a track record of excellence that's second to none. Just look at their thousands of five-star reviews on Trustpilot, Google, and the Better Business Bureau. Customers rave about their knowledgeable staff, smooth investment process, and life-changing results, which you can see for yourself online. That's the kind of reputation you can count on. But it's not just about the reviews. Noble Gold Investments truly care about their clients. They take the time to understand your unique needs and goals, and they give expert guidance every step of the way. That level of personalized service is rare in this industry. Look, when it comes to securing your financial future, you can't afford to take chances. Go with the gold company that has earned the trust of countless investors. Visit noblegoldinvestments.com/Tim Pool today and discover why Noble Gold Investments is the only choice for smart, secure gold investments. Or give them a call at 877-646-5347. Again, that number is 877-646-5347. CNN's ratings are down 90%. Wow, that's bad. You know, a lot of people like to rag on CNN and MSNBC saying, look, their ratings are going down. This proves everyone hates them. And I often would say something like, yeah, but let's be real. Like after an election year, everybody's ratings take a big drop. And, I'd like to point out, like even our views went down, you know, in 2020, it was crazy. We had like 150,000 people watching on an episode talking about politics. And, I try to make sure we're being, you know, fair and reasonable when we mock mainstream and corporate press. But now I think it's fair to actually point out their ratings are abysmal. They can't, CNN's getting like 73,000 viewers in the key demo, prime time. We get 500,000 on YouTube, and we're just some like internet yokels complaining to cameras. That's fantastic. CNN, they're on the way out. The narrative is busted. It's not working anymore, and we're going to have a really good time ragging on the press. We've also got a bunch of crazy news. Apparently, Ronald McDonald House is kicking out kids because they're not vaccinated. We got this crazy report from Bloomberg. EU regulators saying that vaccines, the booster shots, too many, can actually cause problems for the immune system, similar to what we saw from the New York Times. So, as always, we say, make sure you talk to a medical professional. Don't take anything we say as advice, but that's a crazy report to come from Bloomberg. And then a similar report come from the New York Times. So we're going to talk all about this. Joining us today is Batya Unger Sargon, no relation to Sargon of Akkad.
That we know of.
Yeah, sure. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, yes. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so thrilled to be here with all of you guys. I'm a big, big fan of Tim's. So I'm really excited to be here. My name is Batya Unger Sargon. I'm the deputy opinion editor of Newsweek and the author of a book called Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy, that I'm sure we're going to get into. And thrilled to be here.
It's perfect, too, because, you know, we get this report on CNN collapsing. And we have you booked at the same time. It's just very often we get guests that just align with these stories. We got Luke hanging out.
I say it's 10% too little. I think we need 100% ratings to go down at CNN, but that's just my own personal perspective. And if you're looking for a synopsis of what actually happened during the last 2 years, I do believe the shirt that I'm wearing takes the cake for it. As it says, Fauci lied, people died. And if you want to spread this wonderful message of truth, you can on thebestpoliticalshirts.com. And because you do, I'm here. I'm excited for this conversation. It should be fun. Thanks for coming.
Well, hello, everyone. Ian Crossland here. Burning the midnight oil, building free software with an amazing team of developers. And I usually start my day around 7 and end it around 5 a.m. It's been really intense, and I'm happy to be here.
We could see that.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
And I am also here in the corner pushing buttons. I'm delighted to have this author. She's also a second child, which I highly value. Second children are underrated. We're the best in the world. What can I say?
Amen, sister.
Yeah, I'm excited for tonight. It'll be a great conversation.
Don't forget, go to timcast.com. You can support our work directly. As a member, you are helping to employ all of our journalists, our fact checkers, and you will also get access to exclusive members-only segments of the Timcast IRL podcast. We will have one of those members-only podcasts up around 11 or so p.m., and we got some really nasty stories that's like YouTube does not appreciate. So this is where we call it, you know, the uncensored, because we talk about very adult issues. We often swear a whole lot. And this show, we try to keep it family-friendly, so if you want to get the unfamily-friendly version, go to timcast.com, become a member, help support our work. But now, let's get into that news. Here's the story from the Daily Mail. Tuning out, viewership at scandal-plagued CNN plummets by as much as 90% from last year in both overall audience and in their advertiser-coveted 25 to 54 demographic. I'm smiling right now, or I'm holding back laughing, to be honest. Mm. They say the network averaged just 548,000 viewers during the week of January 3rd, a precipitous drop from the nearly 2.7 million viewers from the same week in 2021. CNN in the last year has been plagued by high-profile scandals. Critics have slammed network boss Jeff Zucker over the declining ratings. This is where it gets crazy. Let me read this. Where's that good number I want to see? Here we go. CNN saw an 86% decline in the much desirable 25 to 54 demo, with a paltry 113,000 tuned in last week compared to the 822,000 CNN averaged a year ago.
Wow.
If you want to understand how bad that is, you can just look at our videos and they'll have 350 to 500,000 views. That doesn't show you the live viewer count on these shows, which is often around 250,000 people who watch live. YouTube does this weird system where they're separated and there's different analytics for the live stream versus the people watching the VOD version. But I will just tell you, our audience is like 90% key demographic. So if we're getting 500,000 people per night and CNN's getting none, well, I guess it's good news. The narrative is breaking. The matrix is shattering. People are starting to get away from corporate press BS. And while that sounds really good, I still have to point out CNN gets propped up on YouTube and still gets 100 million views per month
on YouTube. Yeah, this also is a little, you know, an extreme title. They say as much as 90% because they're talking about an election year.
Oh, two weeks? No, they're not. They're talking about 2021.
But they're comparing it to 2020 after the election.
Right.
So like that was a hot news period those few weeks before January 20th, you know. So to compare it to that
No, I'm sorry. I got to correct you. Sorry. It is this week being compared to 2021. So it is fair to say January of 2021 was a
COVID
big news.
COVID has warped my mind, dude. I thought the election was last year.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, it could just be because you've been sleeping.
Wait, Biden's been president for 2 years? Tell me that this
is not right. Yeah, year and a month.
Biden came in 2021.
Yeah.
All right, I'm out of a time warp.
Yeah, a year and
okay,
a
so
month.
Yeah.
That Ian, week. You need to change your sleeping habits. That's another story.
You might be right.
But who would have thought, you know, watching the deep state television is not popular. Who would have thunk it? And again, we also have to understand that overall, you know, when it comes to cable television, their viewership has been going down dramatically. But I don't think CNN has been doing themselves any favors, especially with their lineups, especially with their scandals, especially with Lubin Tubin, the Vanderbilt, Creepy Como, and telling people not to read the WikiLeaks because it was illegal, telling people that there was definitely Russian collusion, obsessing about Donald Trump nonstop when he had two scoops of ice cream. I mean, come on. I can't believe, this is not surprising that they lost 90% of their viewership. I'm surprised they didn't lose all of their viewership, to be completely honest with you.
Well,
from what I've been seeing,
they no longer have the airport contract, but they're still in hotels.
Oh, yeah.
And so it won't be zero.
I haven't read your book yet, but in the book, did you follow CNN at all and go deep on them?
Yeah, the book opens with a scene at CNN with Don Lemon and Kirsten Powers, and they're sitting there talking about how Donald Trump winning is proof of the enduring and unabated white supremacy in America. And, you know, they're sitting there, these two people who are worth, you know, $10 million and $25 million apiece, and sneering and looking down their nose at a president's supporters, a president who won 67% of whites without a college degree, right? And to me, that was sort of the opening primal scene, because I think a lot of what we're seeing here, it looks like it's about politics. It sometimes looks like it's about race, but actually it's about class.
Can you say the name of your book one more time for people who are tuning in?
It's called, I don't know why I can't say it without doing this, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy.
Yes.
Basically what happened over the course of the 20th century was journalism went from being a blue collar job to being the provenance of, you know, the most highly educated, very affluent, top 10% elites. And Tim, I think you represent what journalism used to be. Like the fathers of American journalism, they were populist. They were guys who dropped out of high school or didn't go to high school, working class guys who had to really struggle, who then went out to the people to report and crucially felt a deep sense of responsibility to those people to be responsive to them, to give them what they were asking for and to treat them with respect. And that's been your career in journalism. And that's the opposite of what we see in places like CNN and the New York Times.
I disagree with you, because I would say, you know, a Vanderbilt, Anderson Cooper, definitely has more of a sense of reality and more of a humbleness to him than any of other peasants out there. And clearly his upbringing, you know, his affluence has brought him to be more knowledgeable and more special than all of us.
Yeah. But I wonder if it's not so much about upbringing or anything. Luke and I have had very different, actually maybe even sort of similar, you know, in some ways. Luke coming from Poland, a family that dealt with the Soviet era communist stuff in Poland, and coming to the United States. And it is populism. I think it's also, I want to be left alone, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want anyone to be my boss. I don't want to have a boss. I don't want to be anyone's boss. And here we are, somehow I have a company with employees. But my attitude towards the news is, I'll just tell you and you do your thing. Because I look at it this way. If I got a neighbor, I don't want to be micromanaging and dealing with all of his problems. I want to be able to be like, guy, the reason why you've got this problem here with this, you know, sewage leak is because you did these things. Fix it and leave me alone. Whereas you've got a lot of people who seem to think, these journalists particularly, and these, the establishment political class, let me just be in control of everyone's lives. So it's easier that way. Like, you know, Bloomberg wants to put a tax on sugary drinks so that you can't buy them. I don't have anything to do with it. If you want to drink sugar drinks, you go ahead and do it. I don't care. I'll tell you it's bad for you, and then you can do whatever you want. So I think that right there, there's a meme where it shows a bunch of people and they're all yelling, and then it shows someone at a podium and the journalist has got his back to the podium and he's bullhorning at the crowd, repeating what the podium says. And then it says the way journal, and it's like, that's how journalism is, how it's supposed to be, is the guy with the bullhorn standing in front of the people yelling at the guy with the podium. That's the way I kind of see it, you know.
But what you're describing is contempt, right? My book is about contempt. It's about how the media, which is supposed to be on the side of the little guy, fighting for the little guy against the guy at the podium, right, became on the side of the guy at the podium because they go to the same schools as millionaires and billionaires, and they live in the same neighborhoods as people at the top of the food chain and politicians, and their kids go to the same schools as all these other elites. They are now on the side of power, and they have immense amounts of contempt for the working class just dripping off of them.
I gotta say it. My favorite moment of the Donald Trump election cycle in 2015 was when he ordered that 30-day dry aged steak well done with ketchup. And I could see it the moment he did it.
Totally.
Regular, working class, middle Americans, whatever. They go to the grocery store. They can't afford filet mignon. So they get a T-bone. They cook it through and put ketchup on it because that's the way to make it taste better. Trump knows this. And he was trying to have these people look at him and be like, that's how I do it. And the media laughed and they mocked him and talked about how stupid and uncouth he was. And it just made regular people hate the media. They were like, you're not making fun of him, you're making fun of me. I'm poor. I can't afford your expensive trash with your fancy garlic and volcanic salt Wagyu beef or whatever had.
Yeah. I mean, the way I say it, maybe you would see it a little bit differently, but I kind of want to ping off your perspective, because being in the digital world, being at some of these events, I see two classes of journalists. There's one class that's kind of drug addicted with substance abuse problems, and another class that's the kind of snobby limousine liberals that think that they're better and know better what's for everyone else. I don't see a distinction, and very rarely do I see anyone kind of in the middle of that or anyone outside of those two categories. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, I'll just give you some statistics. So 92% of journalists in America today have a college degree, which is obscene, because you can't teach journalism. You know, you can't teach someone to do what you do, to be a good listener, to ask the right questions, to question your own biases, to be willing to be wrong.
You can.
Well, they're not.
When they're 3 years old.
Yeah.
Like a person learns a lot of these skills when they're very young.
That's true. Yeah. Mm.
So you take someone who's, you know, been brought up in a family that's well off. Maybe got help at their, you know, New York condominium, put them in college and then think they're going to be able to listen. And it's not going
to
happen.
I went to college for journalism for a year, then switched over to theater. But in the journalism thing, I got an opportunity to do my college TV station. I did like sports for the TV station and special reporting. And I also learned how to copy edit. That was, so they were teaching me structure, but not ethics. There's no mention ever of ethics.
Right. So 92% have a college degree. The majority have a graduate degree, which is a purely vanity degree that costs $70,000. To become a journalist in America today, you have to be able to take a starting salary of $30,000 a year. But 75% of those jobs are on the coast in the most expensive American cities, which means you have to come from money, essentially. Like, everyone you see on your TV, everyone you read in the New York Times, these people come from money. They are overeducated and they look down on you. And I think that's what we're seeing, is the American people are too smart for this garbage. They are too smart for it, and they're tuning it out.
I love it. Thank you so much. I grew up in a rough and tumble kind of neighborhood in life. Luke had his, you know, South Bronx and Poland and all that stuff. So I think
Brooklyn.
So I think there's certainly something to, like, witnessing real life and hardship. I have contempt for the elites who think they're smarter and better than everyone else when they're just people. I know a lot of people, and I've met a lot of people in my life, who are wealthy and humble and libertarian and be like, I'm never going to try and look, I've got, you know, thing going for me. I'm going to let you do your thing because I don't want to press. And I respect that. But there are a lot of people who are like, well, my family knows better and I'm better. And there's nothing more satisfying than to see snooty elites with their fancy degrees who think they're smarter and better than everyone fail when they try to go into these news organizations to tell people how to live, what to do, why they're smarter than you. And then they can't figure out why they're laden with debt, why they're struggling to find work, but they still think they're smarter. And you know what? I just sit back and say, if you weren't such an asshole, maybe I'd have some sympathy for you. And to all, and to all of the people I've met who've got college degrees because they were told to do it and got massive student debt and are nice and realistic and willing to listen, I have nothing but respect for them. But there is this class of people that enters media where they just, the way they prove themselves is to get a job in the media so that they can be given access to a platform that they don't deserve, that they've not proven with merit, and then yell at you and talk about how much better they are than you and how you're a bigot and you're racist and you voted for Donald Trump. Well, certainly you're a white supremacist. When in reality, it's probably some dude who's like, I lost my job. My kids need food. Donald Trump says he's going to bring my factory back. And that was it. And they don't want to listen to those people. They're just stupid. Learn to code. Why don't you learn to code? And then when you speak up and say, why don't you learn to code? When they lose their jobs, Twitter bans you for it. Yeah. I can't stand these people. They're elites. They're pompous. They think they're better than everybody.
So let me ask you this. Maybe you don't want to answer this, but when you got to Vice, were you suddenly surrounded by exactly that type of person?
Mostly. In 2013... So I actually met the Vice people in 2011 after Occupy, and it was, Vice was a hole in the wall, man. They apparently, like, took over an old skate shop or something. I don't know the history of that building. It was cool, and that's why I liked them, and that's why when I started saying, okay, now I'm going to take my skills and bring it to actual news, I went to Vice because it was punk rock. They were edgy. They were nonpartisan. The CEO of Vice went on Colbert and he was like, look, we're not Democrat. We're not Republican. We're just storytellers. We're here to talk about what we see. And I was like, thank you. I don't care about this stuff. But when I get in, I got in around the time it started turning into that. And it's because they got money. Murdoch came in. He gave him $70 million. Then I watched one by one the core crew of Vice get fired abruptly and replaced with a New York media establishment, you know, individual, fresh out of college, with the Rolodex. Some people went on, I'm going to go work for Bloomberg, or they came from Bloomberg, and then all of a sudden things just started changing. And I was just like, eh. It's not the scrappy, edgy hole in the wall in Williamsburg. Williamsburg was a dirt hole in New York. It's probably why they set up there. It was cheaper to be in New York, and it was cheap. Well, they helped gentrify the area. They bring in all this hipster youth, and then all of a sudden it's virtue signaling hipsters who think they're smarter than you, and they know it. So I left, and I went to a Disney company, and not better. So they promised it wasn't going to be woke. They were like, we're going to be nice Vice. We're going to be like real. You know, Fusion had a show about drug wars. It was actually called Drug Wars, and they tracked, like, federales and government agents going after the cartels and stuff. And I was like, wow, that's cool stuff. And then within 6 to 8 months, they were like, new editor-in-chief, we're going woke. Everything we're going to do is going to be about wokeness. And I'm like,
what year was that?
2014.
Yeah, that tracks.
Well, so in 2014 is when I started. And then it was mid 2015, early to mid 2015, where they were like, what I think happened was they had one video about a transgender child that got a huge hit. it got them like 100,000 views. And that was one of their first videos that actually got traffic. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they were like, that's it. That's what young people want. What I absolutely love about this is when you have these middle-aged marketing white dudes who don't know anything about what's going on. And so they were asked, like, what's 2016 going to look like for Fusion? And the guy goes, gender. And they're like, and what does that mean? He goes, we're just going to be heavily focused on gender. No, seriously. Ridiculous. And people were like, I don't know what that means. Do you know what you're saying? They got a few big videos, and they decided that was their audience. And then I said, look, man, Luke and I went to Fukushima while I worked there. I'm like, I go on the ground to like these conflict and crisis situations and film that and explore it. What am I going to do? And so they tried to do some stuff like I went to a weapons expo and we looked at all the different like riot control weapons that pertain to like the protest movement stuff.
And we tested them out, but that video footage never made it out there with me and Tim literally having tear gassed, sitting in a chair testing who's going to sit there the longest. If this crazy military guy being like, okay, now we're going to do this. And I'm like, okay, we got tasered too. Do you remember the tasering?
What? I didn't get tasered. You got tasered?
The stomach. There's a video. Was it me or you?
You.
I think so. Tasered. I think I got tasered.
Wait, where did you wake up after
He didn't have the gunshot, the firing one. He had the one that you have to put towards your body. I think it was only like 20,000 volts. But I think, yeah. He hit me. Yeah, it was me. Yeah, I remember getting tasered.
The issue was,
how long did you
The video never made it out to the general public. This is when I was sleeping on like Tim Pool's couches when he was working for Disney.
I'll tell you why. Yeah. So I go to the higher ups and they were talking. We met this guy. He was one of their specialists in weapons training and stuff. And it turned out, I don't want to say too much, but this is a guy of experience, to say the least, international law enforcement, government stuff. And so I said, can you talk to us about strategies for riot control? And he's like, yes, I can. And then I said, we need to go somewhere where we can test all this stuff out. Is there maybe like a field somewhere? You know, we're in Miami, there's a lot of farmland. And they were like, you got it. And I said, let's have this guy. He was like, people can't know who I am because of the work I've done. I work behind the scenes. I said, wear a mask. We'll have you wear a mask. We'll have you do all this stuff. We'll go in the middle of nowhere. So they give us the address and we're driving there. And I see, they're like, okay, we're here. And I'm looking around. I'm like, this can't be right. We're like a parking lot across the street from a McDonald's. There's people everywhere. I'm like, no, this is it. And it was a garage.
Oh, boy.
And the guy comes out and I'm like, you expect us to let off tear gas and flashbangs in a parking lot of a McDonald's?
Yeah, sure.
And that's what they did. And I was like, dude, nice. I don't want to have anything to do with this, man. You're crazy. They brought out a bunch of crazy equipment that made everything look really nuts.
The FBI showed up.
They did?
God.
Yes, remember? I put like a Instagram story or Snapchat story back then, and then the FBI showed up there, and then they were like, what's going on here? And then the guy explained it, and then they went away.
But, oh, wow.
But,
wow.
Yeah.
I was on the phone, actually. I was on the phone, like, being like, what are you guys, what did you think this was going to be? Like, we're supposed to be looking at rubber bullets, foam rounds, tear gas, and we're in an urban parking lot. There's people everywhere. We can't do this. And they were like, what's the problem? And I was like, you want to take responsibility for someone getting tear gassed? I don't want to be involved in that. So yeah, never made it to TV.
Yes.
That's hilarious. Yes, yeah.
So there's footage out there of me getting tasered that's denied to everyone.
Darn it. I'm disappointed. Yeah.
But that timeline makes a lot of sense because the great awakening in the media happened. So sociologists have found that had like a very specific starting point, which was around 2011, 2012, when the New York Times erected its paywall, not coincidentally. That's when you started to see woke terminology start to just absolutely skyrocket mm-hmm. across the major mainstream liberal news media. So sociologists have literally trawled the archives of the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR and the Atlantic and all of these outlets, and they found that words like oppression, marginalization, the word people of color near the word oppression or marginalization, white privilege, it's like a hockey stick. Yeah. Like they were kind of like this until 2011, 2012, they started to totally skyrocket. And what happened in 2015 was white liberals, their opinion as it was polled by sociologists, so public opinion among white liberals started to outpace public opinion of blacks and Latinos in terms of how radical it was on issues of race. So that impact of the skyrocketing of the use of these terms in the liberal media, by 3 years later, 4 years later, by 2015, it had this huge impact on public opinion of white liberals to where they became much more extreme in their views on race than blacks and Latinos and started using this very academic language. And that's kind of where the Great Awakening started.
Did you see that one study that showed liberals, white progressives, are the only racial group in the United States with an out-group preference?
Yes.
So what that means is people who are Hispanic or Latino slightly tend to prefer being around people who are Hispanic or Latino. Black people, slightly. It's like, I think, 18% of 100. So it's like, it's low, but it exists. White conservatives slightly prefer to be around white conservatives, and liberals prefer not to be around white people.
Did you notice?
That's just weird.
Yeah, there's also a correlation with the graph that you were mentioning that I've been seeing online with, of course, Occupy Wall Street, and some people theorizing that this was the corporate media's response towards people going against the big banks, going against the big institutions that have failed them, going against the banker bailouts that have redistributed wealth to the very rich, taken away from the very poor. And from what I'm seeing, it's a perspective of, holy crap, people are catching on to what we're doing. We need to divide and conquer them. Therefore, let's inject this language, which will help create do that. Do you think that is a possible theory?
Okay, or? So I'll give you a less conspiratorial version, and then you'll tell me if you find it convincing enough to abandon the more delicious conspiratorial version, which I could totally see why that's like a satisfying way to think about it. And I totally agree that this great awakening moral panic about race is a distraction from the real divide in America, which is the disgusting levels of income inequality and the class divide. So I agree with that part of it. I do personally think from the point of view of the news media, this was much more about the digital revolution in terms of media. I think it coincided with the New York Times erecting its paywall, because what they started to do was what all of us in digital media do, which is be able to track what terms people clicked on, what terms made them close the browser, what words made them share things, what words made them engage online. And of course, engagement is the big measure of success for digital media. And so I think that there's a much less kind of big picture. There's just like a profit margin to where journalists have always been more liberal than Americans at large. But here you had their corporation saying, no, chase that, racial liberalism because our audience likes it.
I would even go just a little bit further and say maybe the algorithms that favored that were also manipulated because of that larger possible conspiracy. But
same reason.
We could also live in a reality where both are true at the same time.
Well, look. So
I wasn't convincing enough to abandon.
No, you're right.
It could be both.
I'm kidding. Luke's wrong. You're right. Because I've talked about this too. It's not just the media organizations were making money. It's that Facebook was as well.
Yes.
So Facebook incentivized in their algorithms terms like these. Now, I'm not saying I know for a fact they literally said we want this to appear more. But if the algorithm favors, if the algorithm is simply designed, if someone clicks something, show it more, then terms that made people angry, injustice, were more likely to be shared. So this did a couple things. All of a sudden, we saw the rise of the digital blog. We saw the Huffington Post, BuzzFeed. As I often explain, for those who have heard it, forgive me, but for those who haven't, if you write an article that says police are racist, you'll get X views. If you write an article saying police are sexist, you'll get Y views. But if you write an article saying police are sexist and racist, those two keywords gives you an exponential boost. You'll get a bonus to the amount of traffic, because when an article gets a substantial amount of play, the algorithm boosts it more. So now that you're hitting two different communities, the anti-racism and the anti-sexism community, Facebook says, oh, wow, this one got 100,000. Show it to another 20,000. See what happens. Meh, nothing. This one got 100,000. Do the same thing. But when this article gets 200,000, whoa, show it to another 100,000. Keep showing it. That one's getting way more traffic than normal. So the combination of terms gave rise to intersectionality, which was a big component in the precursor of the culture war, which then resulted in a lot of this, wokeness. But another really obvious component, you're familiar with Gamergate.
Yes.
So I can't tell you everything about Gamergate. Now nearly almost 10 years on. What I can say is a video game publication accusing a person of being racist makes no sense. But what happens is, if you are tasked, hey, we're going to make a video game website, what can you really write about? Well, some of these sites would be like, okay, a new game came out. We got a new Zelda game. Let's write all the ticks and all the tricks and tips, all of the items you can get. And then what? And then what? The next day you come into work and the editor goes, what are you going to write about? Well, I just finished writing about the Zelda game. And they're like, we need articles. I don't care. What's going on? this developer tweeted a joke that's offensive, write it up. And then all of a sudden they found the easiest way to get traffic was, can we accuse someone of being a bad person and it somehow relates to video games? And then all of a sudden you have these outlets being like, if we are going to keep writing news every single day, we need an angle.
And that's a result of a dying
angle
company.
Is not video games.
But just really a dying art form, because video game gameplay footage on YouTube took over. So now if you want to watch gameplay review, you don't read about it. You watch it on TV. But, and they were just scraping for life.
There's an important question to answer here. Does the algorithm run us, or do we run the algorithm? So it's like did the chicken come or the egg come
first?
It
runs us.
I would argue that there are people tied into a lot of these bigger, big tech social media companies that are doing social human experimentation, are doing psychological experiments, just like Facebook has done and knowingly conducted, controlling our emotions. And I think there is even a bigger profit motive to make someone feel lonely, to feel sad, to feel depressed. And I think there is a correlation between our mental health decline and, of course, the onset and prominence of big tech social media. So I would say that I believe that both could be true, but I think what is more prevalent is the algorithm running us. That's my perspective. That's how I see my experiences. You see it differently,
no,
which I respect.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, it's not the people running us. It's the algorithm.
It's definitely a combination. It's like a self-fulfilling creation.
We do have the article. This is from The Guardian. Facebook, sorry, almost, for secret psychological experiment on users. They've been doing this. They're probably still doing it. Facebook knows when you poop. But what happens is, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, whoever makes an algorithm, they're aiming for an outcome they can't program for. This is the danger of, I think, one of the big dangers of AI. Mm-hmm. But so YouTube says, we want content on YouTube that is long form with a high retention rate that hits issues, subject matter that people like. How do we do that? Okay, if someone clicks the video, that's a good sign. If someone watches for a long time, that's a good sign. And then we'll show everybody the same words that keep getting clicked. What happens? YouTube starts promoting Hitler doing Tai Chi with the Incredible Hulk singing nursery rhymes.
Yes, so
because it was babies who watched the most and just watched 100% of videos because they don't touch anything.
Oh, wow.
This is what happens when a human programs an algorithm and then lets it run. The algorithm goes wild. So we ended up, like everything we're seeing right now, Rachel Maddow, right? Russia. It's called audience capture. Mm-hmm. Rachel Maddow can't admit she was wrong about it, so she just elides the controversy. She ignores it. Now she's coming out and claiming that Republicans forged electoral documents. The reality is, as is typical with any contentious election, Republican electors in 2020 filled out their electoral slates, sent them to the government. That's it. The same thing happened in 1960 with Hawaii, Nixon, and Kennedy. Well, Rachel Maddow could tell you the truth, but then she won't get traffic. Then her audience won't like what she has to say. So she just plays into that narrative. Humans become servants to the algorithm. After the algorithm chooses nonsense to be popular, the human plays along with it and pushes that same garbage.
Okay, so I think I disagree with you guys. I think that from the point of view that I have, which is the point of view of elite media, or rather mainstream, you know, legacy media, to me it seems like they have very much abandoned the idea of like mass readership. The New York Times is no longer going for a mass readership. They're going for elite, highly educated liberals based on the subscriber model. So now they only have to satisfy those. I think right now they have 7 million.
We don't disagree.
Interesting.
We agree.
Well, so, but I think you can't, like, when you have such a small, everybody now, all the liberal outlets, including CNN, all these people are going for the same. They don't want all Americans watching. They want 10 million affluent liberals. Like that's, and so those people are very specific in terms of what they're looking for.
We agree.
We're agreeing.
We're agreeing. Mm. Yeah, I'm saying Rachel Maddow has a very small and specific audience that she can't betray.
Right.
So she'll say whatever needs to be said to keep them enthralled.
But that's humans. That's not Facebook.
Well, no, what I mean is someone creates an algorithm. The algorithm then generates a kind of content that people get attached to. Mm-hmm. Rachel Maddow then sees, here's a market share I can take based upon the algorithmic manipulation. So a better example is Black Lives Matter and police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
Videos that generate outrage get more shares and more interactivity than anything else. And so Facebook was inundated with police brutality videos. Police brutality accounts for a microscopic percentage of all police interactions, but they get clicks. So you have a generation of kids. This is the next component outside of the media making money. You had kids who were 15, 16 years old at the dawn of Facebook. They go on Facebook. All they see is police brutality over and over and over again because it was making money for these companies. Then by the time they're out of college and they're 22, a few years later, it's 2012, 2013, and they are hypnotized, believing the entire world is police hunting down black people. So their whole perspective is warped to an insane degree. Rachel Maddow and people like her have found a captive audience who believe insane things that they can pander to.
Right. But I have to say, specifically on that example, I feel like that one is very much a double-edged sword. Like, I don't believe that George Floyd's killer would be in prison if not for the algorithm doing that, because that would not have become a national story. And without it being a national story, would we have had that video? Would it have gone that way? And so I feel like there's such a, it's such a double-edged sword there.
But should he
there.
Be in prison?
Oh, I
That's, there's a divide in this country between conservatives.
Is there though?
There is, absolutely.
Really?
Oh, we've gone over that story to a great degree. When the story first broke, we were all very much on the side of like, whoa, that was really wrong of him to do. Mm-hmm. And then when the body camera footage got released, we were like, wow, the media lied to us about everything. Noting like,
with George Floyd?
Yeah, like George Floyd was on a speedball. He had high doses of methamphetamine and what else did he have?
Nicotine, fentanyl. Caffeine, fentanyl, and THC.
He was shooting on a speedball.
Five drugs.
Yeah, but he was strangled to death. I mean.
Yeah, technically I think cause of death was cardiac arrest, but that might have been due to asphyxiation.
No, it was strangulation. No,
there were two autopsies that came out. The family's autopsy said it was strangulation, and then the state coroner said it was
No, but I watched the whole
arrest.
Trial, and it was very clear that it was strangulation.
Well,
I mean, it wasn't even contested by his lawyer.
Well, it's not, I'm not trying to get into
an argument.
I'm down to go deep
because
on that.
I'm willing to have the argument, you know, he should be, you know, manslaughter at the very least. But the issue is that, it's not so clear cut. And you have, you probably have the more conservative side of things saying it's not clear cut that he should be in jail. One example is even in the trial, the use of force expert for the prosecution said that, Chauvin would have been entitled to use even more force than he had already used. So there, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying there were issues where people see it differently. And so.
Yeah. I actually just pulled up here from mystateline.com. I haven't checked it out, but an autopsy report confirmed George Floyd died from a cardiac arrest, which was, quote, complicated by law enforcement subdual.
The cardiac arrest was caused by him being strangulated.
That's what it says. Well, it says it was complicated. Yeah. It was caused by probably complications due to law enforcement subdual.
A better example is
he choked him until he had a heart attack.
A better example is probably like Kyle Rittenhouse.
That's a perfect example. I'm sure we totally agree about that. That was disgusting. I mean.
But this is what happens when, maybe it's even a better example than that, like Russiagate or what I mentioned with Rachel Maddow and claiming Republicans forged documents. There's a desperate need to satisfy your subscriber base. We don't do that. We just talk about what we want to talk about. Sometimes people get mad at us. I've criticized people on the right, and all of a sudden I have people yelling at me, and I'm like, dude, whatever, if you think I'm just going to pander. And then they're like, it's really amazing. A cancel culture does exist for everyone. It doesn't mean, it's not only on the left, for sure.
With the rise of subscription model, this is fascinating. What is the future of journalism? How can you keep a journalistic enterprise afloat and try and be the fourth estate and criticize everything and everyone when you have to have subscribers that'll leave if you start criticizing the people they love?
Yep.
Yeah. So the New York Times right now, 91% of its readership are Democrats. Mm-hmm. Now that takes a lot of work to get there for the paper of record. That's no easy feat, you know, like something they did in the last 5 years, just like CNN, you know, in 2012, as recently as 2012, both CNN and Fox News had a predominantly working class viewership. They had only 25% of both Fox and CNN had a college degree. Over the course of the last, 10 years or whatever, CNN lost half of its working class audience. Wow. It signaled to working class libs, this channel is no longer for you. How did it do that? With wokeness, because wokeness is a smokescreen for a class divide. It's being perpetuated by white liberal elites who are literally lining their pockets with this stuff, you know, to avoid talking about a class divide that they have benefited from.
Let me show you an example that I talked about earlier today. This is from wishtv.com. I believe it's Indianapolis Channel 8. It is fat shaming to point out that people who get COVID and are who are being hospitalized tend to be obese. So we have this tweet from, I don't know who this person is, but Melissa Cancel Student Debt Burn. Is fat shaming the new CDC government policy? The last week of CDC gov tweets has been awful. What did the CDC say? They say a new CDC MMWR finds that 2 out of 3 children and adolescents hospitalized for COVID had one or more underlying health conditions, most commonly obesity. Fewer than 1% eligible for COVID-19 vaccination have been vaccinated. Learn more. They didn't insult people for being fat. They didn't say it was bad to be fat. They didn't say you're ugly or you're nasty. They simply said, here's a fact. And that was mocked. So what we see here is, I suppose, virtue signaling, perpetuating a cycle of decay and destruction in this country. So the reality is, if you want to live a longer life, if you want to have a lower chance of going to the hospital with COVID, lose weight, eat better, exercise, talk to a medical professional and a health and nutrition specialist who can help you live better. But instead of hearing things like, why not take some vitamin D and get some sunlight and breathe some fresh air and get some exercise, we hear everything has to align perfectly with whatever tribe people find themselves in. This woman, it's fat shaming to point out a fact. Well, that's the tribe they're in.
But it's also like, look how lovely and slim she is. Like the person tweeting this, like these people, like, you know, there's such a hypocrisy there, you know, the same thing with like, you see this a lot with marriage, right? Like you see this sort of liberal culture that's, you know, often telling people, oh, marriage is an antiquated institution. Like people don't have to get married. Stop shaming people. You know, we have to promote all kinds of family structures. And the people saying that are all, you know, affluent, highly educated people who are married, who are, you know, benefiting very much from marriage from an economic point of view, because marriage has been very much correlated with higher earnings. And so you have this kind of like this tiny, tiny elite that is impervious to the costs of its BS, right? To the costs of saying, oh no, it's totally fine to be obese. Like that'll never hurt you. You know, like we have to respect people's choices to be this way, right? Or it's not a choice, right? Like while at the same time, they would never in a million years allow their own children to live in that way. I find it really, really, it's terrible.
Obesity is definitely a choice. In 2003, I started to get obese, so I stopped eating McDonald's and drinking Coke every day for lunch.
Well, it could be
and
both.
I didn't get obese
it could
as a result.
Some people have a genetic predisposition, some people don't.
Maybe, I mean, but to eating, I don't know. Fasting is like a lost art. We need to reintroduce
it. It's true,
that.
But there's still the reality of you can't gain weight if you don't ingest the calories. So it may be more difficult for some people, but people could choose.
I don't know. I just look at cheesecake and I'm like, gain the weight. But
Hold on there. I've been doing keto. Cheesecake is very fatty, so it's excellent so long as it's sweetened with allulose.
Yes.
Or erythritol. Mm-hmm. I don't like erythritol though, the sugar alcohol stuff. But we've got keto cheesecake. And it tastes exactly the same. In fact, you know, we got some in the green room. So you can try it.
I will definitely be partaking of that.
It's really good. That's
I got some regular cheesecake. I'm going to be partaking in that myself.
I want to learn how to make it.
For the record. I want cheesecake.
But the bigger
the
issue.
The larger cheesecake. Issue of like that, you know, like people like living a lifestyle that benefits them and their children and then hoarding the benefits for themselves with this rhetoric that sounds like social justice, but actually is sentencing the poor to live much worse lives that they would never let their own children live.
Exactly.
That's the point.
And They're just trying to do it for profit? Like when you see these ads, like it's okay to be large.
No, that would be so much easier. That's the thing. Is like Yuval Levin has this great quote. He's like, Washington would be so much easier to navigate if everyone who showed up was like, heh, 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 I'm going to get all the money and all the power. When actually what happens is everyone shows up and says, I am going to heal the world. I'm going to fix everything. I'm going to make everything better. Like this woman truly believes that fat shaming is worse than dying of COVID. Yikes. You know, that's the thing, is like they really believe it. And I know this because I was once one of them.
Well, take a look at this image, this famous image from Cosmo. This is healthy. 11 women on why wellness doesn't have to be one size fits all. No, it's not. Obesity is not healthy.
But she's not obese. She looks great.
I think technically that is obesity.
No, that's near morbid obesity.
Yeah, that
see,
is
Americans obesity. Have become so desensitized.
I get
to,
so annoyed
to
when people
issues.
Like, eat a steak, eat, and like, dude, stop eating for 18 hours.
She looks great.
She's probably morbidly obese.
Really?
Yeah, Americans are so desensitized to what overweight really is. You'd be surprised. Like people who we would describe as chubby in America are obese. This woman is probably morbidly obese, or at least on the border of not the fattest you've ever seen. And then this woman here, clearly yeah, I would assume is morbid obesity.
She also looks great to me.
I mean, as a human, I mean, much sure, love for
by
that,
all means,
but
you can
no,
say.
She looks really healthy. Like, it's clear that she has a lot of muscle.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I think it's true. It's possible. It's 100% true that one size does not fit all when it comes to health. But I do have to say that this was actually probably my biggest red pill when I was 11 years old. I looked at what feminism had to say about the fat acceptance movement, and I was like, are you effing joking? That is not going to help women live longer, happier lives. If they really wanted women to live and see their grandkids, they would be promoting being active, finding something that you like to do, like yoga, doing something healthy with yourself.
There's so many negative health consequences of being overweight.
Yeah.
Higher blood pressure,
heart disease
especially.
This bothers me.
I don't see any muscles. I'll just be honest with you. That's just my perspective.
Maybe.
But a lot of this is being done in the guise of helping them. Like, we need to help them. We need to stop fat shaming them. We need to stop making them feel bad. But essentially what they're doing is hurting these people even more later down the line because they're not being real with them. They fake caring about them, because if they really did truly care about someone who is overweight, they'd be like, okay, you know, let's do this. Let's hit the gym. Let's work out. Let's change your diet.
But
let's get away from the
GMO. Like, who do you think they have a line into their brains? Like, nobody's buying this. Like, nobody, who do you think they're convincing? They're not convincing anybody.
They're virtue signaling.
Yeah.
These people. These,
so it just
they
makes
want to
them
be known.
Feel good. It's not actually, there's no person who's like, should I go on a diet? No, I don't have to because.
Well, I would disagree.
I would actually disagree.
Really? Yeah. Because these are people of influence. Mm-hmm. We've seen this in a lot of the corporate press saying fat shaming is bad. It's okay to accept your weight. There's even, you know, people giving out little notes to individuals, to their doctors, saying, hey, don't ask me about my weight, which is absolutely ridiculous. Your doctor should know how much you weigh. They should know how much your weight has changed. One of my favorite memes is all the pretty obese health bureaucrats that were deciding on people's health. And Joe Rogan made a very kind of interesting point about this, because he said, you know, himself, I've been working on my health almost my entire life. I've been hitting the gym. I've been watching what I eat. I've been making sure I take the right supplements. I make sure I rest. And there's someone who does the complete opposite of that, to telling me what I should be doing for my health. You know, that should be something we should consider. We shouldn't make it the end all be all. But at the end of the day, you know, tough love and just being real and honest with people goes a lot further than just kind of patronizing them and pretending to care about them, which I think is going to lead to more harm.
You know,
but also you could go too far with it. Like, every time I go to LA, I'm like, this is a godless place. Mm. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's pure materiality. It's pure body worship. And it's like, there's no spirit at all. It's kind of gross.
And if you look at the fashion industry, they are normalizing, you know, women to look like prepubescent boys.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of that has to do with the Jeffrey Epstein connections, but that's a whole nother thing to even get into.
Oh.
But there's a lot of, you know, Jean-Luc Bernet, Les Wexner, there's a whole lot of individuals, Victoria's Secret, that are involved in portraying this image of perfection of these, like, girls who are way too young, who look like little boys. That's something that needs to be addressed, and I do agree with you. That's also another issue that should be talked about, should be addressed, just as the same as this one, because it's in the same realm of providing an image that is absolutely unfair and skews people's minds to what the reality of our real life is. And so do Instagram filters. They have a huge negative consequence for people's mental health, because they get this image portrayed that everyone's perfect, they don't have any wrinkles, they have the perfect bosoms and the perfect glass shape of wine of whatever they want to describe themselves. Hourglass.
Yeah.
Who knows now?
Wine glass bodies with the central hold.
Yeah, hey, look what we were just looking at just a few moments ago here. Tell me I'm not wrong. That,
two white wine glasses upside down.
Yeah,
right?
There you go.
That makes sense. Thank you, Ian, for saving me.
So
maybe a red wine glass on the bottom.
The main issue I was trying to get to is we have a definitive fact that I think the CDC said 30% of people hospitalized for COVID are obese.
Yes.
We then have these virtue signaling media types saying you're fat shaming by telling people that.
Yeah.
It's going to get people killed.
Yep.
If I could speak to this, just because I have struggled with my weight throughout my life, as people can probably tell, I'm struggling with it again. I'm getting a little chubby, as chat likes to point out.
Oh my God, what are you talking
so
about?
So here's the deal. I am concerned.
The standards here are way too high.
No, it's fine. I just know how I used to look and how I looked before that. So I'm like trying to get back on target with my health. And it's interesting to me and horrifying to watch compassion taking the place of factual observation. Because I understand wanting everyone to feel like they look beautiful. I completely understand. As a woman, 100%. very, I feel deeply that everyone should understand that they are unique individuals and have like this unique perspective in life. But when it comes to helping people live their best lives, their longest lives, and get the most out of life, I think it's essential to point out the things that are dangerous. And I'm very sorry that health has become so emotionally oriented, because it's very, very important for people to live their fullest lives and to be their best selves, to have an understanding that it feels good to work out, that it feels great to see yourself get more flexible and stronger, that it's really key to living a better and stronger life. And with the COVID thing, I think this should be a turning point in the American understanding of our own weight as such a key component of what happens to us in the hospital. We've disconnected from that. We think that what we eat has nothing to do with how we live and how we experience life. But
yeah. When we start looking at the larger impacts from the sugar industry and the factory food industry, there's a lot to unpack there with what is happening to our health right now that definitely deserves a real discussion. And I think they're preventing it from happening.
Yeah, they for sure are. When Michelle Obama got into office, I should say when Barack got in, she started the Let's Move campaign, which was basically let's move and cut sugar out of our diets, everyone.
Yeah.
And then a couple weeks went by, radio silence, all of a sudden the sugar industry is part of the White House group and it changes into an exercise campaign. Let's get up and move. But what they're telling people is you can eat crappy food and then burn off the calories and you'll be back to zero. That's not how it works. Yeah. You don't, if you can't drink Diet Coke and then work out and expect to be healthy, you can't put that stuff in your body. They don't put poison in your body. And this industry, like the tobacco industry, has commercials on TV peddling it to kids, this addictive substance, sucrose. Like there's some value to it for sure, but it's a drug. We gotta treat it like a drug.
Sugar's a drug.
So Eric Adams, who's New York's new mayor, who's pretty great, he has this, he's a vegan. And he became a vegan because he got diabetes and he started to lose his vision. Mm. And apparently as soon as he became a vegan, 3 weeks later it all came back and all the symptoms started reversing themselves. And he pushes veganism as a kind of racial justice thing because he says, look at the foods that our community is consuming. These are like foods that we had to learn how to make because of slavery and because we were only given scraps. But now it's keeping us enslaved and it's harming our bodies, and we have to have this. He has like a whole metaphor for it. And it's very cool. But I tend to think of the obesity epidemic very much along the lines of like the deaths of despair, like from alcoholism and opioid addiction and overdose and suicide. Like it's happening among the lower classes. It's happening among the poor. And to me, it signals like a kind of hopelessness, a giving up, a sign of like a spiritual dearth and a lack of connection to the nation, like an inability to see yourself as an active participant in building up the nation, because comes back to economics, you know, the offshoring of these great jobs, like downward mobility of the working class, where you no longer see your life as being on an upward trajectory.
Let's talk about the paradox of anti-racism.
Yes.
These woke people say that they are anti-racist. But as we know, according to Ibram X. Kendi, anti-racism means actively participating in discrimination. GeekWire writes, Trulia to drop neighborhood crime data from home listings after Redfin speaks out against practice. You're going to love this one.
Oh,
they say, given the long history of redlining and racist housing covenants in the United States, there's too great a risk of this inaccuracy reinforcing racial bias. Christian Taubman, Redfin's chief growth officer, wrote in December 13th post, we believe that Redfin and all real estate sites should not show neighborhood crime data. There is something profoundly racist about taking down crime data and saying it's because it's racist. Isn't it paradoxical?
That's disgusting. Because the implication, of course, is that black people, right, don't also want to know where crime is so they could avoid it, right? It's so disgusting.
Yeah, I guess they think it's like they have this, everyone should experience all of the crime. That way no one, it's not one
equality.
Group that does.
Yeah.
Yeah, equality. Everyone suffers. Is
it's
that
so
is that,
disgusting? The erasure of the victims of crime.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's because it embarrasses white liberals that the perpetrators of these violent crimes are people of color, that embarrasses them, right? Because it doesn't fit with the anti-racism where black people are the oppressed and white people are the oppressors. They are willing to erase the victims of these crimes, children being gunned down in their neighborhoods every day, and no one will talk about it.
The issue with crime in big cities and in this country is always poverty. Mm-hmm. You take a look at impoverished white neighborhoods, you'll see a high level of crime. You take a look at black neighborhoods, impoverished, high levels of crime. And what they do is they put a racial component on it, which makes everyone immediately assume the crime is race-based. It's a class issue. That's my big problem I take with wokeness. It's basically, it's a scapegoat for the wealthy elites, as you mentioned. It's a class issue, but they disguise it. And it makes these liberals feel good without having to actually change anything. They're not going to move from their white enclaves. They're just going to pretend like they're doing something by removing the crime stats from their websites. Meanwhile, they all know where they're living. They all know where they come from. They all know what they want to do and how they want to do it.
Anti-racism is very racist.
Yes.
And Chloe Valdere, I believe, said very plaintively, called it counterdependence. So you can have a codependent relationship with racism where you're like blatantly racist and scream at people like, you're worse than me. But having a counterdependence on racism is also racist. Trying to use racism to combat racism because you hate racism. Yeah. And you'll go to any lengths to stop racism, including be racist.
But it makes no sense. A lot of this.
And it is racist.
For what reason does Redfin or Trulia have to remove crime data?
This is just a virtue signal. And this data isn't going away just because they're not putting this filter on top of the map anymore. They have the data. Their rich allies have the data. The people who want it will get it. The normal people will not have it. And that's disgusting. I think that's the hypocrisy you're talking about.
I'll tell you exactly why I can't stand the Democratic Party and overwhelmingly the establishment left. They are willing to ignore reality for the sake of tribe. Now, certainly the Trump supporters have that element too, but they're not in power. They don't control cultural institutions. And I just look at COVID data. I take a look at the vaccine mandates, the mask mandates. I take a look at how they virtue signal this way. I take a look at how they tell people Black Lives Matter said they want to disrupt the nuclear family, even though we know the nuclear family is a huge component. It's related to success and a better living. When it comes to all of these policies, rich people are exempt. They're always exempt. Rich person wants crime data. They simply go to a service and they pay the money and they get it.
Right.
And if you're making millions of dollars, what do you care about spending $1,000 on crime data? But they'll remove it for you, mm-hmm. the average American. When it comes to vaccine mandates and mask mandates, rich people don't got to worry about it. When it comes to air travel, oh no, everybody's got to wear their mask. They want to fly on planes. Joe Biden says, maybe we'll do a vaccine mandate for air travel. The rich person says, I'll just take private. Why do I care? It's always something negative for the poor and the working class. I take a look at going back to the Trump years. You had Americans suffering. These small towns were being gutted and destroyed by neoliberal policy, sending factories overseas. And then when these people said, we need help, and many of them wanted Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton wins. They say, okay, we'll take Trump. The response from the elites is, you're all racists and you're perpetuating white supremacy. And this is where we are today. The aftermath of all of this fake virtue signaling garbage.
Yeah, this article reminds me, it's kind of similar to what happened on The View in 2015 when we had Kelly Osbourne said, we can't kick the Latinos out because who's going to clean our toilets?
So this she was, really said
she
that?
She said that on air, on national television.
Wild.
And when you look at a lot of these kind of wokest, when you look at a lot of these kind of anti-racist apologist, many times these individuals are the biggest racist themselves because they believe that they're better than other people and that they need to help them because they're so much better in all circumstances than other people because of their skin color. That viewpoint is absolutely absurd, and it's white knighting to the absurd levels.
This explains the white progressive so well. Authoritarian, elitist, and racist all at once, but guilty about it. I think I was talking to someone. I worked in LA for a little bit. I lived there for a little bit. And people were telling me that celebrities are really scared. They're really superstitious. So they donate a lot of money to various causes because they're worried about karma. You know, they do this movie, they make millions of dollars, and they feel bad that they're living this way. So they give money away. This is kind of the same thing. I think a better way to explain it is Warren Buffett. When he said, I can't remember exactly what happened with this, but he was like, we should do a pledge to give away half our money or something. Mm-hmm. You remember that, Luke? Something like that.
I remember that, yeah.
And I don't think it had anything to do with him actually caring. I think it had to do with him hedging his bet that there was going to be a class war and people were not going to tolerate his wealth. So he's like, I'm giving stuff away. So when I see this stuff, these are white supremacists with guilty consciences.
Mm. Yep.
These liberals, these progressives, they're deeply racist individuals. They push deeply racist policies. They've actively tried to get civil rights legislation repealed in California. Which proposition was that where they tried to repeal from their California constitution the civil rights provision? No joke. They tried to remove that because they said, well, once we get rid of it, then we can help the poor minorities by giving them preferential treatment. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's an LA celebrity, woke, whatever. And she was advocating for this, saying we need this proposition. They called it the affirmative action proposition, that by removing the non-discrimination clause from our constitution, we will be able to help poor minorities go to school and get better jobs and better government contracts. And so I asked my friend, what percentage of California is white? What is it, like 70%? Can you pull that up real quick? Sure. I think it's upwards of 70%. And I said, do you think, and what about like Central California and a lot of these smaller towns? What percentage white do you think they are? And she's like, oh, I probably like 99%. I was like, yeah. Do you think these people are all racist? Do you think white people are racists? 71%. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, I think, you know, white people are deeply racist. And I said, okay, so when you take away the constitutional provision that bars racial discrimination and give a 71% white majority the ability to discriminate, do you think they're going to all of a sudden give up that power or entrench it? That's what I think, honestly. I'm not so worried about the small town white, you know, majority putting up, you know, whites only or anything like that. I am worried about these progressive Hollywood types who will be like, oh, well, you know, why can't we do that? They've already done it in Seattle with their, you know, they had the, what did they say? Diversity, people of color room and non-POC room.
Yeah.
Have you seen these?
Yeah.
When they start segregating. So forgive me if I don't trust these activists when they claim they're doing it for altruistic reasons.
Dude, it's like Bill Gates really quickly. I just want to make a reference because there's an example I could make here. When he said he was going to give off all of his wealth to charity, he literally doubled his wealth in a few years. So that's the type of individual. Sorry, go ahead, Ian. Well, I just needed to say that.
I wonder how many times you got to see a movie where the guy's like, quick, give me the ultimate power item. Quick, quick. And then you give it to him and he's like, yeah, thank you. And he turns and uses it on you. And you're like, dude, like, you don't give that kind of authority to someone.
I don't really believe that if California got rid of that provision in their constitution, all of a sudden all the white people would be like, now's our chance.
But that would eventually happen in an entropic system.
What I mean is, for my friend to claim that she's woke and she believes white people are all racist,
right,
to then want to give the white majority the power to discriminate against people based on race makes no sense. And they won't back away from it. Her response to me was, yeah, well, you know, it's the right thing to do. And I'm just like, do you actually care about the logic of helping poor people? Or is it just, I'm going to say whatever my tribe tells me to say, so I'm popular?
Okay, but we have two parties in this country. And one of my big gripes with Republicans is like, okay, it's true, you're not all white supremacists, but where's your counter offer to fix the remaining problems that we have with racism? Like, there's nothing there. There's nothing doing. You would think they would be showing up in the black community and saying, hey, I'm going to give you school choice, get your kid into a good school, and I'm going to put the criminals away so your kid doesn't get shot on the way to that good school. And they don't show up.
Well, so the Republican establishment doesn't, but the populist Republicans are starting to do that.
They're starting to. It's true.
Well, so that's what we need.
But, like, very, very slowly, and it's sort of like...
We need everybody to primary every establishment politician, be it Democrat or Republican. Yeah. And then we can get some Democrats who say the exact same thing as Republicans say the same thing. And because populism is the answer regardless of your economic position. I don't care if you're a laissez-faire populist or a communist populist. If we find key issues we're going to work together on and then we can argue about the rest of it, excellent.
Right.
Instead, what we have is the Democratic establishment is obsessed with Trump. The Republican establishment just obstructs. And then we get nowhere as, you know, Americans who are trying to actually solve our problems to live better lives. This is why I think one of the reasons Trump wins. At the very least, Trump was like, I'm going to bring your factories back. I'm going to bring your jobs back. I'm going to deal with the opioid crisis. I'm going to deal with our border crisis. We're going to end these foreign wars. Far from perfect in a lot of these things. But hey, he didn't start any new wars. He triggered, you know, he set the timeline for getting us out of Afghanistan. He tried getting us out of Syria. He did bring many of our factories back. Joe Biden comes in, everything falls apart once again. I feel like now they're just the establishment politicians, namely the Democrats. Here's what I see happening. Let me slow down. It was always the same with the Democrats and the Republicans, the uniparty. Bernie and Trump staged an insurgency from the left and the right. Bernie is weak. He gave in, he caved, and now he toes the line. He has been absorbed into the machine. Donald Trump is a crazy person who kicked the door in screaming and took over, and now a large portion of the Republican Party is controlled by Trump and his supporters. There still remains establishment Democrats in control, but they're slowly being weeded out. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, these guys, in my opinion, are awful. Even Ted Cruz has proven himself to be weak and feckless. Then you do have a lot of populist Republicans who are a little too aggressive, but it's better than the establishment, in my opinion. The Democrats have doubled down and redoubled their efforts. The neocons, who were booted out of the party, jump sides to the Democratic establishment with, like, the Lincoln Project, and now start towing all of that line. So that's it. The Uniparty is in the Democrats. They are extracting as much as they can from this country as the ship is sinking. Mitch McConnell, his whole attitude is, well, I'm going to stand here and do nothing and be a speed bump, while the Democrats are like, the only thing you should care about is Donald Trump. And Nancy Pelosi goes, buy more stocks as I change the laws. I don't believe any one of these politicians, save a small handful, actually care about making this country better. I think for the most part, they all see it as, what can I do to ensure my family's wealth and success because the country is collapsing? That's what I see across the board. So my hope now is that come the primaries, people go to the Republican Party and they vote out every single one of these establishment Republicans, all of the, and then you get some working class individuals, American populists, and the same thing happens to the Democratic Party. I hope the Democrats get some, you know, I it doesn't really fly on the left, but moderate working class populist center left individuals to get rid of the Democratic establishment corporatist crony garbage and the woke trash. And then the Republicans need to do the same thing to the neocon war hawks and corporatists as well.
And then repeal the Federal Reserve Act of 1913.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, we're headed towards zero.
Yeah.
We got to get rid of that stupid corporation, man.
I don't know. I feel like decentralization is our best bet. Less centralized power at the federal level, you know, is our best opportunity. Because right now what's happening is both sides are trying to fight for supreme power.
This is actually the first time in history that it's never been better to create a decentralized government.
What gives you hope, Tim? Like, what is your positive vision? Like, what? Yeah.
I mean, gun rights. Wow.
Uh-huh.
That's fantastic. Gun rights have been winning across the board. And that, it says more than just guns. It says that regular people are focused on their individual responsibilities.
Autonomy.
Yeah. Autonomy. There is still a semblance of, also a lot of people expect the country to fall apart. But I wouldn't say any of this is pessimistic. Mm-hmm, I think it's fairly optimistic. Mm-hmm. I think the populism is winning. Day after day, we can see that anybody who toes the establishment line is mocked ruthlessly and insulted and derided, and they're not going to survive politically. Adam Kinzinger is the best example. He comes out and he tweets an insult at Jack Posobiec, and I'm just like, bro, you're not going to win a re-election if you're against Jack Posobiec. Mm-hmm. Jack is a very prominent conservative personality. He's million plus followers or whatever. He does a big podcast. So you don't got to, the left doesn't like the guy, but on the right, they love him. If you're a Republican and you're like, I oppose what these people stand for, you may as well leave. So these establishment guys are going to lose. I think the same thing's going to happen on the Democratic side. 26 Democrats have announced their retirement because they know they're done. Kinzinger announced his retirement. He knows he's done. The establishment is broken. It's falling apart. CNN's ratings are in the trash. Our ratings are through the roof. Crowder, Glenn Greenwald, Jimmy Dore, success across the board for populist personalities who actually believe in the working class. I think that's great news.
Mm-hmm.
I think the night is always darkest before the dawn. Things may get pretty bad. I do think we're on the verge of some major conflict that's going to happen. National divorce could precipitate some serious fighting over resources, but ultimately I think it's going to get a lot better. You know, if you believe in the Strauss-Howe generational theory, then we are in the fourth turning, the period of tumult and crisis. And that means after 2028, things are going to get really, really good. And we're going to have 40 years of growth and prosperity, 20 years of stagnation, and then 20 years of crisis and collapse again. So,
you know what's marked for 2029?
What?
Peak graphene.
What is that?
Graphene's carbon.
Here we go again. Carbon. Take a drink, everybody.
It's a material, like, and it's going to be, it's carbon. Uh-huh. But they figured out how to make it as a monoatomic layer, just one layer, atom-thick layer of carbon. It's got amazing properties. What are you using it for building materials in the 21st century? Pure carbon. You can get it out of carbon dioxide. We can withdraw the carbon dioxide and make buildings out of it, basically.
Oh. I got this guy a Christmas present.
Tim got me graphene for Christmas.
Graphene, because he's obsessed with graphene.
But the market has – I was doing a lot of research in 2018 looking down in Chile to build a company down there to start producing it, and everything was pointing to 2029 as peak – the year that – global society is going to embrace graphene.
We have a button. You can't see it. And whenever we feel the conversation's going in circles, I press it, and a big thing lights up saying graphene, and it flashes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it cues Ian to just...
I also have a shock. It shocks me.
It does, yeah.
From under my seat in case my eyes are closed.
There's a DMT one for the after show, but that's a different story. But to kind of ask you, what gives you hope? And to kind of also, while you're here, I think it's fair to say that we kind of see the solution as very differently. But we agree on the problem. We agree that obviously the billionaires are controlling too much of our existence. We believe that the banks have absolutely printed money out of thin air. We believe that we're controlled by multinational corporations that call the shots. Populism has never been heard by the government. Is there hope for us working together somehow from these different perspectives on these larger populist ideas? Do you see populists from the left and right potentially ever coming together?
I get hope from going around the country, talking to people everywhere who are working class, who are completely don't care what who their neighbors voted for, who are totally post-partisan. Partisanship is a completely elite phenomenon because elites make money off of it. And so I get a lot of hope talking to working class Americans because they have hope. And I think that I still feel stupidly like I don't know how we do it without, I'm struggling to have the vision that you have, like to see past the current moment. So I feel a little bit like I'm still struggling to point out, like, to the media itself, like, hey, you guys are corrupt. Could you be a little less corrupt? Working class people are human. Can you treat them better? You know, like, I feel a little bit like but I feel super hopeful about America. I love this country, and I think that its people are getting better and better every day. Like, I think that we've seen a huge, huge revolution on the right in terms of how it thinks and talks about race and how it thinks and talks about things like police brutality very recently, criminal justice, stuff like that. So I get tons of hope from the unity I see everywhere except in the elites.
Well, let's talk about hope.
Yeah.
I have something that I think could very easily explain some optimism for everybody. You used to be a woke journalist. And you're no longer. You wrote a book against it.
Yeah.
So tell me, like, how do you find yourself? Like, how do you end up as a woke reporter and then one day have an unwokening and become anti-woke?
Yeah, my deprogramming. It was like a bunch of things, you know. It was like very slow and then all at once. But I definitely had the Trump derangement syndrome. Mm-hmm. It was like in the beginning, it was very hard for me to talk to. I took it very personally that he won in that super lame liberal way, and it took me a while to be able to admit like, that's a really good thing he did. Oh, that's a really good thing he did. But my deprogramming, I think it started with learning about the depths of despair, and every night I would turn on CNN and see the very people who we had abandoned, who were literally killing themselves because they didn't see a future for themselves in this country, killing themselves, being mocked on CNN, being called racist in the New York Times. Like, and that sort of started to really, like, it was jarring to me. Like, why do we not have compassion for them? And then the second thing I would say was I read this Yale study from 2018. Do you guys know about this study?
No.
You're awesome. Really,
there's a lot of studies from
Yale. You're really going to love this one, though. You do, right? Yeah.
Maybe.
Yale did a study in 2018. What they found was there's a difference between how white liberals and white conservatives talk to black and Latino people.
Yes, I remember the study. Great study.
Oh, yeah.
Top tier.
And it found that white liberals dumb down their vocabulary
incredible.
When they're talking to blacks and Latinos, and white conservatives do not. And I remember reading that in 2018 and thinking to myself, this implicates my entire worldview, and I was not ready to deal with it, and I put it aside. But I had this moment where I was like, this is disgusting, and everything I think is caught up in that thing that makes you dumb down your language. You assume a person of color is less educated than you, is poorer than you, and needs your help. and needs your generosity and your beneficence, right? That move of, like, I instantly recoiled because I recognized it. And then the third thing that really, I think, was like the death of my Trump derangement syndrome was my rabbi is just the best person that I know. He's the kind of person who, like, in the winter, he walks down the street and he sees a homeless person. He starts taking his clothes off and giving them his coat and his scarf and everything. He's just the most humble, generous person I know. And we were, you know, having a Shabbat meal once, and, you know, Trump came up and he was like, "Oh, I love Trump." Oh. And I was like, "Excuse me?" And he was like, "Yeah, I love the guy." And I was like, "You mean you voted for him, you know, holding your nose?" And he was like, "No, I love him." And it was like that. And that's what I tell people. Like, people often ask me, like, how can I convince people to not be woke anymore? And what I say is, like, you can't really change someone's mind with information. Our brains aren't wired that way. What you can do is you can be a person who is so humble and virtuous, or strives to be virtuous, so clearly trying to be a good person, that a person who disagrees with you can no longer say about everyone who holds your opinion, they're racist, they're evil.
Yes.
But I think that's for liberals, it's a liberal perspective. I think conservatives have a tendency to be swayed by facts and information. Huh. Not all of them, obviously. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Obviously, there's very emotional people. And I think the left has a tendency to be swayed by feelings. It's why Ben Shapiro tweets, "Facts don't care about your feelings," and gets 50,000 retweets and a million followers, and everyone's cheering for him on the right. And on the left, they're very much driven by, you know, care and fairness to cite specifically Jonathan Haidt's research.
Yes,
you're familiar?
Yes, yes, of course.
Yeah. Conservatives have all six moral foundations. The liberals have two.
But when Ben Shapiro really? Says facts don't care about your feelings, he's kind of making an emotional statement, you know?
But it's the point stands. And the inverse is true. For the left, feelings don't care about your facts. But Jonathan Haidt's research found that conservatives, when they take a moral foundations test, they have a balance of all these different moral foundations, which is it's care, fairness, purity, authority, freedom.
Yeah.
And there's one more.
But you're super anti-authoritarian.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the divide, the political divide, is it's obviously not left or right.
Yeah.
It's authoritarian versus anti-authoritarian.
Oh, interesting.
So if you're someone who I think liberals have a tendency towards authoritarianism, and I hate using the word liberal because it doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
But whatever modern American leftism is, because they're collectivist, and collectivism is inherently authoritarian, because if the collective, which is the authority, decrees, you either follow suit or you're ostracized. So if you're someone who is driven by care and fairness, and that's it, you don't care about loyalty, purity, authority, or anything like that, or freedom, liberty is a moral foundation. And if you don't have that, well, then you don't care if they're doing vaccine mandates. Let me tell you something I think people really need to understand. The left and the right don't speak the same language. They come out right now in New York City and they say vaccine mandates work. Let me just ask you a very simple question. Do you think vaccine mandates work?
No.
Why not?
Well, I think they're unconstitutional.
Well, that's not a question of whether
they work.
Oh,
you mean do they work at preventing the spread?
I didn't say that. I said, do they work?
Do they work? And with no qualifications.
No qualifications. Do you think they work?
Do I think they work? I don't think they work.
And why is that?
Well, because of Omicron.
So this is really interesting because people on the left know this. They know New York is experiencing a massive surge in cases. But when they say vaccine mandates work, they're not talking about preventing COVID. They're talking about forcing people to adhere to the collective, which is you must get the vaccine regardless of the outcome. Mm. On the right, they say vaccine mandates don't work because COVID is still spreading like crazy. So that's a really interesting distinction between the two cultural
definitions of the word work.
Right.
Yeah. The left today is also deeply meritocratic, not in the sense of a real meritocracy, but in the sense of they're deeply careerist and deeply obsessed with credentials and with
that's not meritocracy.
It's okay. So we agree to disagree, but
well, it's authoritarianism. It's look, getting a college degree doesn't prove you're a journalist.
But it's very individualist, like the desire to rise above the pack and tell everybody else what to do and become famous and become, like, that to me seems really individualist. Like,
No. I mean, in North Korea, you want to be a party member. In China, you want to be a party member. You want to be a part of the collective at the highest ranks to prove your value to the authority. Mm. Whereas, on the right, you have a tendency towards libertarianism, which is get off my property and leave me alone.
Right.
When someone says go to college and get a degree, they're not saying, get an education. They're saying adhere to the cult, adhere to the authority. You get, it's remarkable to me. I meet so many people who are you know, I'm going to go to college and get a degree and then get a job. I'm like, what is that degree going to do for your job or what you want to do? Nothing. They admit this. They say it's a piece of paper that proves you've done something. Millennials, my entire life, have said this. When I'm like, what's the point of getting a college degree? It just proves you did it. That's authoritarianism. The adherence to the authority. Me, I've always been libertarian. I dropped out of high school. I said, screw college. I'm going to make my own way and decide for myself. And I don't care what you think, and you can't tell me what to do. Conversely, or subsequently, I don't want to tell you what to do either. Just leave me alone. Those are the big differences.
But isn't populism and libertarianism in tension with each other?
Not necessarily. Why? Why do you think that?
Because libertarianism, to me, signifies like free trade and...
But that's big L libertarianism.
You know, you're libertarian more, you're like wacky. a civil libertarian.
It's just a... Do you have a tendency towards live and let live, or do you have a tendency towards do as you're told?
Right. What we should call liberalism, except liberals don't believe in that.
Got New York City, now St. Paul, Minneapolis, they're now enforcing a vaccine mandate. Cook County, the second biggest county in the country, vaccine mandate. And we're watching record COVID cases. So what is the point of the vaccine mandate? They repeatedly say it works. On TV, they say it works. In New York, they say it works. Well, it's not stopping COVID. Oh, but the vaccine mandates are getting people to drop down, bend the knee, and give in to your authority. Mm-hmm. In that sense, it is working. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they mean when they say it works. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're finding people.
And then
in
I look
Quebec.
At Luke, and
I already have something lined up.
I'm sure you do.
Talking about what was happening in Quebec with of course the premier there setting up a tax on the unvaccinated. He's calling it a health contribution, but in reality, it's just theft. The Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, also says that he supports this strong measure and most likely will be implementing this kind of exploitative measure on the Canadian public as a collective. You better be a part of our gang or we're going to steal your money. That's essentially what's happening right now in Quebec and what's going to happen nationally throughout Canada in a few days.
Look at this article from the LA Times. Ugh. Mocking anti-vaxxers' deaths is ghoulish, yes, but necessary.
It is, yes.
No, it isn't. It convinces no one of anything. What is the purpose of mocking an anti-vaxxer's death? Seriously, it's to gloat so that people on your side can laugh and feel like they're part of the group. I call it a cult because the way cults work is convincing a person that everyone loves you, you're right, you're on the right side, and they're the crazy people. Don't listen to them. Don't talk to them.
Is that a photo of the author?
No, that's a photo of a woman who died due to COVID who opposed mandates.
Okay, because I was going to say that's like of that publication to use the photo of the author would have been like clearly signaling what had happened here, which was like they knew that this piece was going to go viral for hate and they were putting a target on the back of the author. And they like this is something no editor, I'm saying this as an opinion editor. This piece got a ton of the kind of traffic like you dream of as an editor. Yep. I would never have let somebody write that because you just know that it's so ghoulish and it's only going to get hate shares. And essentially it's like this editor just did not have the back of that writer.
It's not just one editor. I mean, how many people are probably involved in the process of this getting approved?
Right.
So if our goal is to make a better country and to help people, do you think it makes sense to go to someone whose wife just died of COVID and laugh and mock them and say, your wife's up? An effing moron. What a dumb piece of garbage. Haha. And then high five your friend. Is that going to convince them to join you? Is that going to convince them to get vaccinated? No.
So actually, interestingly, people don't know this, but Walmart has had a campaign to help vaccinate people. And it has been incredibly successful in the two most vaccine hesitant populations, African Americans and Trump voters, as well as evangelicals. Big overlap there. And when they asked them, like, why are you succeeding with these populations that nobody else can get vaccinated? Their answer was, we're meeting people where they're at. Mm. And they partnered with local leaders who had a lot of trust in the community, sports teams or pastors, or there was one community of Latinos who were very vaccine hesitant, and they found a local publication in Spanish, and they had a press conference in Spanish and then partnered with an immigration center. And so, you know, I know you guys are probably ambivalent about this, but basically what they found was that meeting people where they were at was the vaccine. Like, that was how you, but it was the opposite of mandate, opposite of shaming. Respecting people's distrust because you earned their distrust by being, untrustworthy.
Is there zero improvement in this country by mocking people who have opposed mandates? If someone's wife dies of COVID and you show up, you're wearing a suit at the funeral, and you walk over and you pat him on the shoulder and shake his hand and say, I'm sorry for your loss. I'm here if you need anything. Here's my number. Seriously, give me a call. We'll grab a drink at any time. And then you can have those conversations. And then you can say, well, you know, look, man, I mean, you look at these numbers and people who are vaccinated are less likely to be hospitalized. You can have a real conversation. And the person might still disagree, but you're having a real conversation. Are you familiar with Daryl Davis?
Yes.
Perfect example.
Oh God.
He's amazing. He's the black jazz musician who said, I just want to meet these racists who hate me who never met me. That was it. He didn't have a plan to de-radicalize Klansmen. He just said, I'm going to go talk to him.
He drove the children of a Klansman to see their father in jail every week for years. And they were still so racist. Amazing. I mean, it took years for them to stop. He's amazing.
Hmm. Yeah, he was like, well, you know, how are they going to know if they don't know? And you got to talk to him. And that's exactly it. So it is tough, though, because we have the data and we discuss it quite a bit. People on the left traditionally do not follow people on the right and don't seek to engage with them. People on the right are the inverse. They constantly seek to engage with people on the left, and they consume news from all different political spectra, political outlets. In 2016, this is what Jack Dorsey said, left journalists, liberal journalists, did not follow right-wing journalists, but right-wing journalists follow both right and left-wing journalists. So this is why a lot of people on the right weren't surprised that Trump won. We had, I think it was Max Kaiser, who's not a right-wing journalist or anything, he's a financial guy. He said, it was him and Stacey, they have the Orange Pill podcast. You guys check it out if you're interested in crypto. They were in Europe. I could be getting the story wrong, but the general I remember it as they were in Europe, and they were hearing all across the media that Trump could never win, that everyone hated him, and it was a slam dunk for Hillary. And they flew back to the U.S. and landed in North Carolina and saw nothing but support for Trump, signs everywhere, and they immediately said, Trump's going to win. But why was the media so disconnected? Because they don't follow anyone but themselves. So we see that still today. We actually pulled up, there's a website called ground.news, and you can put in someone's Twitter handle and see the political bias of the outlets they interact with. When we pulled up left-wing personalities, it was like 80 to 100% left-wing.
My God.
When you pull up moderate personalities, it's mixed. Uh-huh. When you pull up conservatives, it leans conservative with a little bit of left in there.
Mm-hmm.
But many conservative personalities follow left-wing publications. People on the left don't do the same thing.
But again, I just want to make the point that, like, that sounds like a story about politics, but it is also very much a story about class. You know, if these journalists lived in working class neighborhoods or knew any working class people, they would not have been so shocked by Trump's victory. But they don't. They live in these extremely affluent, wealthy, you know, Hillary Clinton plus 20 districts. And this is data has showed this. A Politico survey found that, you know, journalists, 75% of journalists live not just in blue districts, but in the most blue districts.
Yep.
Looks like a story about politics, but is actually a story about class, about how, you know, the Republican Party became the party of the working class and the Democrats became the party of, you know, big tech, Wall Street, which gave more money to Biden than to Trump, and then highly educated liberal elites.
Did you see this story in 2016 from Vox? June 3rd, 2016, left-wing publication Vox.com. Democrats are replacing Republicans as the preferred party of the very wealthy. And that is true today. And the neocon establishment conservatives, like the Lincoln Project, fled to support Democrats. And even after 2020, the Lincoln Project said, now we're going to go after Republicans in the Senate. And conservatives were like, why? We thought you were the party of Lincoln. You just opposed Trump. No, they're establishment politicians. My favorite story, maybe you saw it, was during the George Floyd riots. There was a guy in L.A. who was cheering on the rioting, saying, yeah, yeah, get it, go, go, until the rioters started coming to Beverly Hills. And then he tweets something like, no, don't come to my neighborhood. Why are you coming here? Go downtown.
Disgusting.
It was amazing to see the contempt and disdain for regular people as the rioters were destroying the neighborhoods of the poor, and he cheered them on and then panicked.
We got to be careful that we don't get too excited about the vindication as the wealthy start to suffer as their dollar gets closer and closer to the value of zero because the French Revolution. You just look at past revolutions where people rise up against the elite. It can go really bad really fast, and you don't know who's going to try and take power if something like that were to happen. Rather than revel in seeing them fall, maybe we can help them and help them change their behavior.
It's not about the wealthy. It's about the who are the nobles that would inbreed and then Russians? It was
pretty much all of them.
Yeah. And there was
the
that
royal
one,
families.
There was one famous family where like the guy was like, and it was like his jaw was all messed up. I'm like, that's how I view most of these people. They are the product of this insular culture they've developed where they isolate themselves from regular people. They come from old money. They're extremely arrogant and disdainful, and they think they're better than you. I've met people throughout my life who came from wealthy families who became, very humble. And they were like, I'm really, I know some people who are wealthy, who are born into rich families who would say, I'm really careful to enter politics or anything like that because I've not experienced what most of the people have gone through. And so I don't want to assert myself over people. I'm like, that's the right way to do it, man.
So Tim was referring to a very famous family called the Habsburgs since like 1273. And they were notoriously an inbreeding family and developed this weird lip jaw deformity looking thing. So check out the Habsburg.
Or don't.
Most monarchies are inbred.
Yeah, and they would do that to maintain, keep wealth within the family.
Yep.
You'd have to sell half your wealth to your son's wife if his wife is your daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or cousin.
Gross.
I don't know, I'm fairly optimistic when I see the success that we have. Everybody who's a member at TimCast.com, everybody who supports us in Super Chats, we're growing, we're hiring, we're expanding, we're doing more every single day.
So as a news organization, how do we like you were saying with subscription model, we have a core group of people that like what we do. And fortunately what you do journalist wise is rip on everybody that's messing up for the most part. So maybe you don't have to target a type of person. You know how like the New York Times is going out of their way to supplant these.
Well, look, I'm anti-authoritarian. That's about it. So if a person is a working class person, but they use their voice to try and force other people to bend the knee, I'm going to criticize them. For the most part, though, I'm more concerned with the power structures themselves and the ideas, which is why in a lot of stories, we don't say the person's name or we'll specifically reference a person who did this instead of calling out someone individually. I don't care about an individual. I care about the structure and the system and the person. But there are some people who are so high profile, we talk about them. Nobody's perfect, right? It's not a perfect, there's no simple way to just ignore everybody. But there are a lot of people, especially on YouTube and in the political space, who their whole career is insulting and targeting a single person.
Oh, it gets so old so fast.
Yeah. But, I'm optimistic. I see the populist growth, the expansion success, and I think the censorship may be bad, but, Rumble's doing really well. There's more systems on the rise. I don't think, it's like all of these movies and stories and heroes' journeys, all these comic books about a villain who wants to take over the world, and they always fail. You cannot, as an individual, no single human is smart enough to seize control of everything, and they fail every time they try.
Oh, yeah, and if they were to succeed, they'd be offed by the number two in command in a holy second, and then that guy would be offed by the number three who would become the new. You saw it in the Roman Empire. That's why we don't aim for centralization of authority.
Yep. There will come a day where, I walk into the room and then everyone, takes a rubber mallet and hits me in the back. And then Ian walks over and hits me and I say, I look up and I say, you too, Ian.
Your time has come.
You too, Ian.
Let me get my hat.
That's two. All right. But until that day, we'll be like old. Smash the like button. Subscribe to this channel. Go to TimCast.com. Be a member. We're going to have that member segment coming up at 11 p.m. But we're going to go to Super Chats right now and take your guys' questions and comments. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. All right, let's see what we got here. Forlorn Vox says, you lads better stock up. They're about to push vax mandates for truck drivers this Friday. Oof. Yeah. So that's why, you know, today I shouted out safeandreadymeals.com.
Yes.
Emergency food supplies. It's one of our sponsors. I don't shout them out all that often because it's like, it's an emergency food bucket, but store shelves are running empty. Inflation is up 7%. It really feels like everything is, you know, getting worse. And if they vax mandate truckers, you ain't getting nothing.
I will say we went to the store the other day and we saw empty shelves. And I was like, I don't know if this is normal. I don't know if it's stock date, but I've never seen this before. And the other thing I would mention.
Where was the store?
That was right in Frederick.
Wow.
Yeah, right in my neighborhood.
But I don't get it. Truckers are alone in their trucks. Why do they need a vaccine?
Like authoritarianism.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything other than say to the person, you do as you're told or else.
Do it. Yeah, I was going to say, though, that there have been places where they've tried to put these vax mandates in place, and they have had to walk them back. They did it at my dad's company because they were going to lose a significant percentage of their highly trained, you know, workers. They're like, oh, no, we can't do this. All right, I guess we have to walk it back. So I'm very optimistic that truck drivers are going to be exerting the pressure to get them to stop because this needs to end.
Here's a funny one. Nolan Conway says, hey, Tim, have Carl Benjamin on. I think the reason we're getting that comment is because your last name is Unger Sargon, and Carl Benjamin goes by Sargon Avocado, or he used to.
Yes, yeah. I am the lesser Sargon.
Oh, no.
Well,
not at all.
You know, he's in the UK. Carl's a good friend. He's always welcome to come on the show.
We should
have him on together. Sargon on Sargon. That'd be awesome.
I would love to get Carl and
Count Dankula.
I don't
know him. What's his deal? Is he on Twitter?
He's banned from Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's pretty,
he's on Getter.
He was relatively controversial like 3 or 4 years ago for getting banned for saying some off-color, well, you could argue they're off-color comments on another platform or on another person's show. And then they came and they banned his channel. And it was really, really scandalous.
John Chambers has a good idea. He says, you need an event January 22nd as many of us are coming to DC for the January 23rd anti-mandate march.
Well,
we
do have a really big, sorry, I wasn't sure if you were going to throw it to her, but I was going to say we do have a really big show planned for that Monday because people are going to be in town for that rally, and that's kind of exciting. So you guys
we do have a big show planned?
17th. Yes. It's big. It's really big. I know you know what I'm talking
about.
I don't
know
what
like
date
that.
It is. Yeah, it's going to be great.
It's okay. I know what you're talking about. It's all right.
It's all right.
Well, we should definitely reach out to the people at the event.
Yeah,
right?
That's a really good idea. I like that idea.
I think I'm going to be attending that event myself.
Yeah,
Dr. Malone, Peter McCullough, the Weinsteins. There's a surprise celebrity guest as well that they're kind of telling, like, say it's going to be big. So I think Robert Kennedy Jr. as well. I don't know if he's 100% confirmed, but it's going to be a lot of people. I'm going to be there, definitely. I want to be there for this event. It's a Saturday. Absolutely.
So that Friday is the 22nd. I wonder if any of y'all who are going to be at that event want to come on the show?
Let's get all three of them. Let's get McCullough. Let's get Weinstein. Let's get Malone. All three here. That would be incredible. And Robert Kennedy Jr. Let's set up extra cameras. That would be huge.
Talk about asking for trouble on YouTube. But I'm down. I'm down for it. Absolutely, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah. Super fun. Yeah.
But we'll talk about mandates. We'll talk about policy, and then you know we can do a members only, maybe like a Rumble exclusive. Before or after the show, talking about other issues.
Be fun. Yeah, sure. We can do.
That'd be really great. So if y'all are listening and y'all are down, I'll hit some of these people up. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Also,
fun.
Weinstein, if you ever need it. Like Einstein, Weinstein. The smart guys are Weinsteins, not Weinstein, like Epstein.
That's what I said.
Yeah, that's one way to remember.
That's fair.
Or was it like a Weinstein? He was big in the news.
We Jews got to be clear
time.
What kind of Jews we are these days.
Yeah, let's be crystal clear.
It would be like an Epstein. It would be like a Weinstein, an Einstein. Yeah, I like that. I approve. That's nice.
That's hard.
Well, this
it.
Is crazy. Andrew Kolasar says, spin doctors have ousted their star bassist, Mark White, for refusing to get the jab. He's on Instagram, Mark B. White. Also, check out my music.
I love the Spin Doctors, man. Not at least in the
90s. Name more than one song.
Little Miss Can't Be Wrong, Two Princes, Jimmy, Pocketful of Kryptonite. Dude, that album is awesome.
Pocketful of Kryptonite. Yeah, yeah.
What's the one song everyone knows from them?
4:30. What time is it?
No.
Little Miss Can't Be Wrong or Two Princes. Those
two
are their
Princes
two huge hits.
I know, yeah.
Two Princes?
Yeah.
Which song?
But to be
yes, that
girl,
one.
You,
yeah, that one.
Doctors. All right.
That might be a little mistake.
Johnny California says, Vice was cool back when all they did was hang out in Colombia doing donkeys for less. Vice used to be fun. Yeah. You know, they would go on the ground
great.
And explore weird things. Bulletproof clothing, the sex shop in Japan, scopolamine. And now they're all just ultra woke tribalists.
The big banks came in.
No, that is what, yeah, yep. So I was told by someone who was a higher up at Vice, the investors were concerned about negative press and cancel culture, so they told the executives, either you go woke and embrace feminism, or we revolt. And so they did. And they were like, all right, that's what we'll do. And it was around, you know, 2014 or so.
Brought to you by Bank of America. Mm.
Brought to you by
Wraith Fraser. Customs Firearm says, Luke, don't tase me, bro. They tased.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. It wasn't like a long taser. It was like he surprised us with it too, because we were there standing,
bro,
and we were filming, and then out of nowhere he's like, "Okay, I'm going to teach you, you know, this stuff," and he's like, "That came out of nowhere," and he didn't say like, "Hey, get prepared, we're going to taser you. Do you have any heart conditions?" He was just a wild, crazy guy who was super interesting and super fun, and I wish we would have released that video because it was just wild. And then literally, me and Tim got sat together. We didn't know what was going on. He liked surprises, this guy. Tim was sitting back to back to me, and then he throws something, and he says, "We're going to see who stays here longer." And I'm like, "All right." And then
it was like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And we were both like, "Nope."
Yeah. And it was some like serious tear gas, which is
all right. But Brett S. says, congrats to Tim Pool's Beanie for making it into iTunes number one hip-hop song Controlled by Bryson Gray featuring Anomaly. And then he says something I can't read because it's in Polish. Na Zdrowie?
Na Zdrowie.
Oh, yeah. Na Zdrowie. How do you say that?
Na Zdrowie.
What does that mean?
You don't want to know.
Okay, it's really gotcha.
It's like, whoa, like.
He's lying.
Luke's lying.
Luke's lying.
He's making it up.
Thank you for your kind words.
I am not a good liar.
No, no, you're not.
I'm a really
it says, keep it up, guys. That's what it means.
Thank you, sir.
Maybe.
How
do you know? You don't know Polish.
Don't know. True. I'm
well, Ian, can
it right
Google
now.
Translate?
I'm okay. Translating it right now.
Nozdrovia. How do you spell that?
Don't tell him. Don't tell him. But bad.
I don't know how to spell it.
Hunter says, hi, Timcast. Slight correction to something said the other day with Brandon. You did not need a license in Texas to buy a handgun in Texas before constitutional carry, just to carry one in public. Oh, really? I read somewhere that you need to take a handgun course. You have to get like a special training or something.
Yeah. You know, along those lines, I learned I've been talking a lot about student loans and compound interest and how students are getting rocked by it. Most student loans, I found this out, someone messaged me on Twitter, thank you for sending me this, are not compoundly interested. They're just standard interest. I didn't know that, but that's most student loans are standard interest and not compound.
Grant Thompson, he's got some words for you. He says, this woman didn't watch the trial. Only the prosecution stated that he died of strangulation, despite him having a lethal drug dose, an enlarged heart, COVID-19, and O2 saturated blood, e.g. he could breathe.
Mm. Well, my understanding from having watched the trial was that based on his, not to speak ill of the dead, but his habitual drug use, that the amount that he had ingested beforehand would not have been enough to cause cardiac arrest, and that the cardiac arrest was caused by the strangulation, and that some part of that was not disputed by the prosecution. But thank you for the correction, sir.
Didn't he have a lethal dose of fentanyl?
I thought
like
he did,
three
yeah.
times lethal dose?
He for sure had an intoxicative dose.
Yeah, but the prosecution stipulated that based on the level of his habitual use, which they got from one of the witnesses who was his girlfriend, and he was a very big man.
Yeah.
And his, you know, his level of muscularity and his workout, et cetera, that would not have been lethal.
I'll tell you my thoughts right away. You shouldn't go to prison for doing drugs. You shouldn't, none of this should have happened over a counterfeit bill.
Yeah.
But he was behind the wheel of a car while chewing a speedball.
Yeah.
And this is what got him pulled out and detained. And then if you watch the body camera footage, he's resisting arrest.
You mean when he was arrested? Yeah.
He's sitting in the SUV chewing on a speedball behind the wheel of a car.
Yes.
And you know, I've argued the libertarian point of like, people should be allowed to do drugs. Everyone comes back with, dude, he's behind the wheel of a car, an SUV no less. And I'm like, it's a good point, man. Like, I'm all for allowing people to do whatever recreational drugs they want, but you can't drive if you're doing it. And so the cops pulled him out to detain him. When they brought him to the police SUV, he kicked his way out of the car screaming, put me on the ground, put me on the ground, put me on the ground, three times, and they did. Whether or not that warrants four people going to prison for the rest of their lives, I honestly don't think so.
Well,
I do think there's fault.
I mean, when you watch the video, all of that could be true. He could have even put his knee on his neck until he was subdued. I think the problem was He was subdued and he kept his knee on his neck for 5 minutes after he was no longer moving.
That's true.
And it's like, what is going through your head at that point when this person is saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, and then totally passed out under your knee? Like, at what point do you have criminal liability for someone's life?
But is it life in prison or is it like manslaughter in a few years, you know?
I mean,
like, how is justice served by four people? The three rookie cops who were just, who showed up confused, having no idea what was going on, now all going to prison for the rest of their lives.
As a person who doesn't believe, you know, I'm sort of very ambivalent about the carceral state, I hear that point. At the same time, like, I think we have to say that human life is infinitely precious. And when you participate in something that steals one, as a society, we have to have a way to say, like, you were there to serve and protect, and you stole a life. And it was like the look on their face. Okay, I'm like a lefty, so of course, like, come back to the compassion and the feeling or whatever. But the looks on their imperviousness to his suffering, to the point where they allowed him to literally die. Like, they stole his life when at any moment during those 9 minutes, someone could have intervened, and they didn't let anybody intervene.
This is the problem I have with authoritarianism and collectivism.
Yeah.
Those three cops, not Chauvin, were doing as they were told. I don't know if they deserve to go to life in prison because they were just doofy and just sitting there confused and not
listening.
But
have they been sentenced to life in prison?
Well, they're all getting, I think, federal civil rights charges. So, okay, maybe it's a little hyperbolic to say life.
Yeah, I don't think they're gonna get life in prison.
They're gonna get decades. I mean, like, Chauvin's never getting out.
I don't know, is a civil rights abuse, I don't know what the sentence for that is, but it's not murder.
They're all charged with murder, aren't they? Am I wrong about that? I'm pretty sure they're all going to get a murder charge and then a federal charge on top. And then they're probably going to get a state prison sentence and then transfer to a federal prison afterwards. Like, I think the whole prison system is busted up. And so, you know, my problem with all of this is that the Black Lives Matter groups say, you know, abolish prisons, abolish police. And then the moment they get a court victory, they cheer and say, lock them up.
I know. I don't want to be one of those
people.
You know, I think about human life and the preciousness. I get that's a risky path to go down because, like, stealing someone's life and doing something that might create a situation where it's harder for them to survive are very different. Like, if living my most just life means that there's no food for those people, I didn't steal life from them. They're just going to starve because I was the one that beat the system.
No, but in that case, your life is infinitely precious as well. Anything you do to keep yourself alive, I think, is consistent with that principle.
There's a lot of this.
I mean, in the Torah, you have to save yourself before you save others. That's.
I think one of the problems I see with the whole Chauvin thing, and I don't want to go too long on this because it's like an old issue and we've got a lot of questions, but when the prosecution's defense said, according to protocol, Chauvin was entitled to use more force than he did use, that showed restraint on the part of Chauvin.
But all of his bosses who had trained him disputed that. So this was the thing that was so amazing to me about this trial, and I agree, you know, I'm sure your viewers are dying to hear what you think about it, but to me it seemed like it was a trial about the nature of policing, and it was the prosecution that had an optimistic view of policing in America and said this is not what it means to be a cop. To be a cop is an honorable position, and they brought on cops who broke the blue wall for the first time to say this is not what we were trained to do. And it was the defense who had this pessimistic, ugly view of what it means to be a police officer who are like, no, this was just like policing, you know, as it's supposed to be.
But so do you think that what we got was making an example of someone?
No.
I mean, those three other cops who didn't have their knee on the neck, should they be charged for this?
Not for murder, no.
But
not
they're all being charged for it.
Yeah, so that would be, I think, an overstatement. But
Chauvin showed up late. He showed up after everything had already happened, and they said, we need help subduing this guy, and then he walked over and he put him in the restraint where it's so complicated to rehash, so maybe we shouldn't, but it wasn't just that his knee was on his neck for 9 minutes. That was debunked in the trial. His knee was on the back and the neck back and forth, or for like a certain amount of time. That doesn't change the fact that he could have stopped at any moment and provided medical treatment or anything, so that argument I understand. But I think what we have right now in our judicial system is retribution to placate rioters. And that's what we've been getting across the board. That's why the Kyle Rittenhouse trial was so monumentous for a lot of people.
Okay, so I see it a little bit differently. And this, okay, leaving Floyd aside, to me, that week where we had the Rittenhouse trial come in, verdict come in, and then the Ahmaud Arbery trial come in.
Which was wrong.
What they did.
No, the conviction, the sentencing was all wrong.
Really?
The guy who filmed it, who had nothing to do with the two McMichaels, is
going
to prison.
No, but what about the McMichaels?
So that's a whole philosophical debate. I mean, if the police come to your house and say, we need you to help stop this guy, he's a burglar, uh-huh. burglary suspect, he's a felon, and then you see the guy running down the street after your neighbor says he broke into his house, or he was seen trespassing in the house, which makes him a felony burglary suspect, some people are going to say, okay, this is the guy the cops were looking for, we're going to go stop him.
Do you think?
I think you shouldn't get in your truck and go chase a guy down, you should call the cops. But it's not an issue about what I think. It's an issue of, do these guys deserve life in prison after these are some, you know, look, I'm not trying to be mean, but dumb yokel guys in their community that has been plagued by burglaries. The burglaries were so intense that a gun had been stolen from one of their trucks only 3 weeks prior. So there was a fear that whoever the suspect was armed. The neighbor had just seen this guy enter his property in the middle of the night mm-hmm. illegally. It's burglary when you enter a property in this jurisdiction. And then the police go door to door and say, this is the guy we're looking for. And then one day these guys are like, that's him. The guy the cops are looking for who's been terrorizing the neighborhood. So the younger McMichael grabs a shotgun. They flank the guy. Ahmed Arbery is running towards them. He could have run through the grass. He could have done a lot of things. Granted, if someone pulls a gun on me, I might be like, I'm going to subdue them too. Arbery goes around the truck and then grabs the shotgun from Travis McMichael and fights for it. The gun goes off in the struggle, killing Ahmed Arbery. Now, you don't have an argument about whether they were justified in trying to do a citizen's arrest based on the law, and that's where the real question came up in the conviction. But look at what happened to the guy who followed behind. A guy saw what was going on, saw them running after, chasing after him in the car, and he said, I'm going to film this. And because he filmed it, the criminal trial happened in the first place. So they're putting this guy in prison for the rest of his life. The whole thing is busted and broken, and it was just to placate rioters.
Okay, so I see it a little bit differently, and it's funny because the thing that I thought was so interesting was, I think he was lynched. I think they chased him down and killed him because they wouldn't have made the mistake about who it was if he wasn't black. And
what mistake did they make? That was the guy the police said they were looking for. He's on security camera footage illegally entering a property.
But he had not stolen anything.
But that's not what makes you a felony burglary suspect, right? So stuff had gone missing. A gun had gotten stolen. Power tools had been stolen. But that night prior...
So the police said, we're looking for this guy. But he had not actually stolen anything from the property that he had entered, which was like this construction site, essentially.
But that doesn't... That's not relevant to the case. The prosecution even said he was a felony burglary suspect. So this is a mistake I made, and we actually had a couple of lawyers on. I said, look, a guy who trespasses shouldn't be chased down and then, you know, confront him. And I think it was Andrew Branca who said, no, he was a felony burglary suspect, irrespective to whether or not someone saw him on camera in a building. There was a string of burglaries throughout the neighborhood. He was the suspect. That's what the police told the McMichaels. So they said, that's the guy the cops are looking for. And they explained that their intention was to stop him. If you watch the video, they pull in front of him.
Yeah.
They don't chase him down.
Yeah.
And Ahmed Arbery runs towards them and goes around the right side of the truck and then flanks left and grabs the shotgun.
Well, because they were aiming it at him. I mean, they were trying to stop him.
Well, we can't see that. We can't see if Travis McMichael actually aimed the shotgun at Ahmed Arbery. What we can see is he turns right around the truck and then turns left and grabs. And then the next thing you see is they're fighting over
right,
the shotgun.
Right, but if people are trying to, you know, arrest you and they have a gun, it's a reasonable thing to... But the point I wanted to make is that the Rittenhouse trial was so disgustingly politicized and got so much attention by liberals who were trying to cast not just Kyle Rittenhouse, but anyone who's defended him as white supremacists, right? They tried so hard to give the impression that he had killed black people, right? This actually got misreported in one outlet.
Book.
Yes. It was in a book?
It's in a book.
That he killed three black people.
Yeah.
Even in the like more legitimate outlets, what they did was they would say, you know, he shot three people and killed two at a Black Lives Matter rally, right? To try to give the impression, even if they weren't outright saying it. And it was so disgustingly politicized in that way. And I met so many liberals who truly believed that he had shot black people. And when I would say, no, he shot a pedophile, a domestic abuser, and a guy who punched his grandmother earlier that week, they would be like, oh, I'm not following it closely. I'm not following it closely. And I'm like, oh, you're following it closely enough to get it wrong, right? But then when the Ahmed Arbery verdict came in, I was watching Fox News all day, and they were cheering that verdict. And every conservative I know was saying, like, those men got what they deserved. They chased that boy down. And
because they're cowards.
But the – well, okay.
No. I really want – sorry to interrupt, but I want to stress this. Conservatives These people, all of them who spoke out and cheered on that verdict, are cowards who are too scared to speak out. When the George Floyd thing happened, on principle, many people on the right were like, that's clearly wrong. We can see his knee on his neck. And then when the body camera footage came out and more in context came out, a lot of people on the right were like, well, I was wrong about that. For me to see everything we covered in the Ahmaud Arbery case, which is not as, it's not clear cut. The media was reporting it just like Rittenhouse, that it was a lynching, that white guys chased down a jogger. This guy was not a jogger. That is a lie. And people on the right gleefully were like, see, this proves the system works, because they're cowards and they're scared. They're still scared. They will still peddle the line for the left, but they want to do it at the speed limit. That's the difference. That's the difference between the right and the left for the most part. I took a look at, I covered the Ahmaud Arbery story. And we had a guy in the studio screaming at me, calling me racist because I dared say any of this stuff. But I don't care what he thinks. I don't care what Tulsi Gabbard thinks because she called it the right verdict. I don't care what Fox News says. They are all wrong. Mm-hmm. When it came down to the conviction on Ahmaud Arbery, what happened was the prosecutor said there's a citizen's arrest law that says you are allowed to perform a citizen's arrest if you have probable cause and you witnessed a crime take place. However, if it's a felony, you need only probable cause. A reasonable person concludes if there is a felony suspect, you need not have witnessed the crime. But the prosecutor argued, no, it's one provision. Therefore, regardless of whether or not it's a felony, you had to have witnessed it. On that instruction from the judge, the jury said, well, in that case, they're guilty. However, if you actually read the law, it says if someone is trying to citizens arrest a felony suspect, they don't need to have witnessed the crime, in which case the McMichaels are stupid, but they were genuinely chasing down a felony suspect as they were informed by the police.
But did they know that law, or does it not matter?
I don't think they knew much about the law at all, other than the police said, we're looking for this guy, and they said, we're going to stop him, and they were concerned he was the guy who had stolen the gun from their truck. So if someone steals a gun from your truck, the gun is missing, you've reported it missing, and then you're told by the cops, we think that's the guy who did it, are you going to show up unarmed?
No, definitely not.
So what ends up happening is, all I really need to say, what should we read more? Otherwise, we'll just keep going. The fact that the guy who filmed it, which allowed the court case to happen, got life in prison and they're cheering for it, just says to me, you need only see that point, and then you need to then question the rest of the case. This guy got in his car and said, I'm going to film this. And that's all he did. And they said, we're going to charge you with murder now. And he was like, but I didn't do anything. We don't care. We want you to rot and suffer because we're scared of riots. That's the same thing with McMichaels. They're doofy, dopey yokel guys who were told by the cops, this is the burglary suspect. They were stupid for doing it, but I don't think they lynched anybody. I don't think they were intentionally trying to cause harm, and sending them to prison for the rest of their lives does not serve justice. But people don't care. They want to feel good. They want to feel like the system works. Fox News doesn't want to be perceived as racist. So when they cheer for Kyle Rittenhouse, they get scared that too many people are going to be like, why are you cheering for this guy? They got their victory. So then they come out and they can say, see, Ahmaud Arbery, that case was ruled correctly. And then we sit down with lawyers and they're like, look at the facts. And I'm like, wow, that was wrong. So anyway, we'll keep going. So I'll read some more super chats and, you know, cause otherwise we're going to go too long. Tara says, Tim, calories in, calories out has been debunked. Please watch Fat Fiction on YouTube. It's very eye-opening into how calories from sugar is dangerous. I believe you are correct.
Yes.
I'm not a nutritionist, but when I say you can't gain weight if you don't eat the calories, I'm still pretty sure that's a fact.
Yeah.
You can't gain weight by just breathing air. So if you are not consuming calories, you can't gain weight. But I think, you know, I hear people like Neil deGrasse Tyson say calories in, calories out, and I'm like, that's not true, man. I cut out sugar, just sugar. And I would like eat tons of salami and I'm losing weight.
Yeah, a calorie is a measurement of heat that's produced when your body digests a piece of food. So you get a lot of nutrition with specific foods that are then the foods broken down. There might be the same amount of heat produced with like a piece of sugar, but all that nutrition is there with the broccoli. Yeah.
Also, the sugar industry, absolutely very huge, very corrupt, and has caused a lot of horrible things in our society by buying off regulators and government bureaucrats.
Brian Doyce says, great guest. Really poignant conversation tonight. Thanks, Timcast peeps. I agree. I think this has actually been a fantastic conversation about everything. It's wonderful. Christina H. says, I'd love to see Anomaly and or Bryson Gray on your show. Happy Wednesday. Love y'all. I'd like to see them both on the show.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, that would be fun.
We could actually, what if we had them on a Friday and they performed the song where they mentioned my beanie?
Yeah, that was kind of my thought.
It's flattery will get you everything.
Literally everything, yeah.
Do you have a copy of your book by any chance? Did you bring one?
No, she doesn't.
I would love to have you and Chloe Valderate. Do you know Chloe Valderate?
I'm actually on the board of her Theory of Enchantment.
She's
amazing. She's great.
You guys have a very cool vibe.
She's amazing. Yeah. We're very close. We're very good friends.
Awesome.
Rocky says, Ian, I love you, man, but I cannot listen to you talk about sugar being a toxin, but actively pursue psychedelics. No one has died from a bad cake trip. That's wrong.
That's not true. That's not true.
Heart disease. Diabetes. And come on. Choking.
Yeah. You gotta be careful. Choking? Hey, all things in moderation. I'm not saying don't ever touch sucrose, but treat it like a powerful drug because it makes you hunger for it. It's a different kind of addiction, not where you think like, I want that. It's just like you're drawn towards it. Mm-hmm. So you gotta watch out for that stuff. And same thing with psychedelics or any kind of drug. If you're ever going to experiment with any of that, be reasonable, you know, and research it. I'm not advocating for that kind of thing, but you got to small doses, man, with food or with drug or with any kind of thing.
Silently in Atlanta says, OMG, Luke, you forgot the other part of the Kelly Osbourne Latino gaffe story. Rosie Perez quit after being forced by show execs to apologize for reacting to the racist gaffe. ABC forced Latina to apologize for being visibly offended by the guest.
Oh my
yikes. Yeah. I didn't remember a lot of it. It was in 2015, but I think it's relevant. I just kind of vaguely remembered it, and that's why I looked it up. But it gets deeper and crazier.
Hillary Wallace says, calories in, calories out absolutely works. It's the law of thermodynamics. Follow the science. That's not completely
follow Fauci.
That's not completely right. I will say, he's the science. I will say it's really hard to accurately measure calories out. Mm. It's easier to measure calories in, but even that's wrong.
Yeah.
Casey Neistat did a great video where he bought food around New York and then got it calorie tested and found that like Subway actually had less calories than they advertised, and most foods had more, or like many of them did, which is really fascinating. What I will say is, in my personal opinion, based on how I've eaten, I think everybody's different. When I eat grains and sugars, I'm miserable. I have no energy. I feel just bad. When I cut that stuff out and I stick to fats, meats, cheeses, and veggies, I feel like $1 million. So over the past several months, one thing I've really noticed is in the mornings, 7 months ago, I'd wake up, I'd have my coffee, I'd put sugary creamer in it with, I'd put a little bit of creamer and then some, you know, like flavored creamer. Cause I'm like, not too much sugar. I'm trying to be careful, but still, you know, some sugar in it. And then I would drink that. And then as soon as I'd finish my morning segment, I'd have breakfast. I'd have like a piece of bread and some eggs. And I'm like, I'm having a good breakfast here. Just like a little piece of toast and some eggs and bacon. And then within 40 minutes to an hour, I'd start getting tired and drained. And I'd be like, oh man, and I need to get something to drink or do something. And then I would get another, you know, like another coffee or something. When I stopped having all the sugars, now for breakfast, I don't eat anything. I just have coffee with heavy cream and nothing else.
You're doing intermittent fasting too.
I think the heavy cream negates that.
Yeah.
But I never get tired. There's no point where I get sluggish or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm sustained throughout the day. So I do all of my morning segments without eating anything. And then as soon as I finish, I'll have a meal. So today, what did we do? We did keto hot dogs. We did Portillo's famous hot dogs, and we made buns with almond flour and egg.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Nice.
Grilled onions. Oh. And I feel great. I don't get tired. I don't get sluggish. And then over the past few months, there have been cheat days where, like, it's the weekend. We're all going out to eat. Everyone's getting dessert. And I'm like, one time I can have, you know, a small piece of this cheesecake. It's no big deal. And the next day I'm just like, oh.
Wait, can you drink on keto? Can you have beer? Can you have
liquors? Very low in carbs.
I think you can have liquors, but you can't have beer.
Yeah, no beer.
I don't drink anyway, though.
It's like
drinking bread.
Yeah, I don't, you know.
Has that always been true?
Not when I was like 18 to 22. I drank too much, but I don't really drink. I just don't get anything from it. Over the holidays, I had maybe that month between November and December, 10 drinks, you know?
Wow.
Because I'm like, people are drinking, having wine, and we had Trump champagne. It was hilarious, and so I partake. Maybe 10's a little little much. No, I think that's right, because I had a couple beers, too. Yeah. All right, well, let's read a couple more, because I don't want to go too long, and we kind of did go too long, so I apologize for that. All right. What do we got here? We got a whole bunch of super chats. All right. JDMC says, Rodney King happened just before Bush Sr. lost election for second term. Democrat old bag of tricks. I don't know about that. That's a conspiracy theory I've never heard.
Mm. Yeah, me neither.
Clinton staged? Or the Democrats wanted the LA riots to happen or something?
The Clintons. No. Old school. I don't know.
That would, no, the riots would actually help the Republican. You know?
No idea.
So.
Must have backfired.
I don't know.
Yeah.
A lot of people are saying, can't wait to see Anomaly on the show. Yeah, that'll be cool.
Working on that.
All right. Let's see. A lot of people are commenting on the George Floyd thing, which I know if we bring up, we'll just rehash again. And I don't, you know, it's, you don't want to.
Sorry.
Do it for the bonus section.
Yeah, we can. Well, I mean, it's just me. JDMC says Ian has been more awesome since he came back from vacation. Love you, bro. It's almost like something happened to Ian.
Yeah, like I fell asleep on the plane when I woke up.
Yeah,
something,
that's true.
Something new.
He woke up in
parallel universe or whatever.
Yeah, it went through a time space.
I actually did microdose psilocybin over the break, and it was incredible. I spent about 10 days in Ohio with my family, and then I went out to Washington State, out to the mountains, and was able to just have a meditative. Amazing, amazing communication experience with a great friend of mine out there. And, I highly recommend getting some time away from a computer screen if you can.
I think I tweeted a photo of you in nature. I don't know if this is
that's
you
me.
Exactly.
But, I don't think that's me.
Totally.
It's a beautiful picture.
I tweeted it.
Thanks.
I love it.
All right. We'll do one more real quick. Mr. Trench Trucker says, as a trucker desperately trying to deliver food, I will not comply. Try to stop my truck. I dare you.
Oh boy.
Well. Be
spicy.
Responsible with your truck.
Yes.
Be a good law-abiding truck driver, but stand up for what you believe in. And I think, you know, nonviolence of disobedience is the way we can push for change while not hurting other people, right? All right, let's see. Here's one more. Mavis says, Tim, you're right about unhealthy image of body weight. I got down to a healthy weight with keto, and my coworkers thought I was underweight when I wasn't.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. My friends, if you haven't already, smash that like button, subscribe to this channel, share it with your friends. Take that URL, post it wherever you can, or if you're listening on the podcast, we're on all podcast platforms. Listen to us there. Tell your friends about it. Go to timcast.com, click sign up. We're going to have a members-only segment coming up around 11 p.m. is when we post it, so you will not want to miss that. You can follow us everywhere, TimCastIRL. Follow us on Instagram for all of our clips. You can follow me on Instagram at TimCast. Badia, do you want to shout anything out? Do you have social media?
Oh, boy. I am at Bunger Sargon on Twitter, and you can find – I work at Newsweek. I try to platform working class voices and voices from across the political spectrum. So you can find those op-eds at newsweek.com, and you can find my book at Amazon or encounter.com, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Thanks so much, Tim.
And I'll just say one real quick thing, too. Newsweek for like a mainstream corporate press.
Wonderful.
You'd publish a lot of dissenting opinions. Yeah. You've got populist right-wing people, conservatives, left. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's fantastic.
I saw a Newsweek article where they said that COVID lives in fat cells. It was a story out of China. Oh. They had to recall all this ice cream because they had tested
he
animal
talks
fat
about it all the time.
For COVID. And it's like Newsweek printed it, and then just like where did that information go if it's living in animal fat?
No.
But thank you so much for coming on. It was great able to have a civil discussion. I know we don't see things eye to eye, but I think we could identify the problems. I think we definitely agree on that. And it was great being able to understand your perspective, where you're coming from, and being able to have a civil discussion. So thank you so much for having that. I have my own kind of discussions and debates and conversations on wearechange.org. I just had a very important video on the way that I think things are run in context to, of course, Epstein, a USA Today article. I did a video about that exclusively on LukeUncensored.com. Hope to see some of you guys there. Thanks so much for having me. And thank you guys for participating in the chat as well.
Oh, yeah, that was great. You can follow me at IanCrossland.net. Batcha. Good to see you. Have a nice night, guys. See you later.
I'm going to take a moment because this is very important to me. I don't usually ask for much time, but I had a gift sent to me that is one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever seen. She made this portrait of my cat. Some of you guys are familiar with Dip and Dot, and it is amazing. It's opalescent. It is made with glass, and it has little whiskers on it that move when you touch them, little hairs. Her name is Lori K. Farr, and she's at LKF Designs on Instagram if you guys would like to follow her. She does customized pet portraits, just like Dip. Absolutely amazing. I'm so touched. It's such a generous gift. She also did one of Bucko. She did one of Luke's dog and some of the chickens as well. So I am just amazed by the gravity of this gift. She also made me these earrings, and I'm going to definitely work with her in the future. Yeah. You guys may follow me on Twitter at Sour Patch Lids.
Thank you, Lori. They got a mosaic of Atlas. It looks incredible. There's so a mosaic cool. for you too.
Yeah,
downstairs.
You
need to
open it.
Yes.
Yes. So
Roberto's our rooster.
Yeah.
And you could see the mosaic and the unraveling on the vlog,
yes.
which was just released today that
yes.
I was in.
Yeah. So cool.
All right, everybody. We will see you at timcast.com. Thanks for hanging out.
Bye, guys.